Good evening. I'd like to call the Wednesday, February 12th, 2020 meeting of the Oceano Community Services District to order. Can we have a roll call, please?
Director Gibson.
Here.
Director Villa.
Here.
Director Repogu.
Here.
Vice President White.
Here.
President Austin.
Here. You all please join me with the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. This time, we will do agenda review, and I'd like to see if we could move item 9A under public comment after item 6. 9A is the presentation of the California Voter Rights Act, and so our gentleman here could be able to leave the meeting sooner than having to wait through all.
So
I was wondering if we could also move up 9C, the bylaws discussion, because I think there are a number of people from the community here. Yes. Or if we could after the presentation of 9A.
I don't see any reason why not. Yeah.
I make a motion that we amend the agenda by putting 9A and then 9C after 6 and before special presentations and reports.
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, then that's what we'll do. All right, now's the time for public comment. So I'm going to say anyone desiring to speak during public comment are asked to fill out a board appearance form to submit to the general manager prior to the start of the meeting. Each individual speaker is limited to a presentation time of 3 minutes per item. Persons wishing to speak on more than one item shall limit his or her remarks to a total of 6 minutes. This time may be allocated between items in 1 minute increments up to 3 minutes. Time limits may not be yielded or shared with other speakers. And I had some slips in. I'll call them first. Nancy Bull had an item for public comment.
Yes, thank you very much. And I do have some photographs to accompany my presentation. I'll give those to you. Yes, I wanted to speak to the problem of fireworks getting out of hand on the 4th of July. I live on Strand Way, and it has become extremely dangerous. And there are two of the photos that show damage to my house from fireworks, but they are completely beyond reality. And also there are some of the photographs show the debris that's left on the beach. And, of course, no one actually cleans that part of the county road. People clean down on the beach, but I appear to be the only one who goes around and picks up the trash after the 4th. So I'm hoping that you can put on the agenda and put into an enforcement program more effectively that will do something about controlling the fireworks explosion that goes on in that county road section of the beach down there. There are people who have fireworks that actually are more effective, that are higher than the ones down at the city. And one of the pictures that you have shows one of them coming from two houses down. That is actually the city's behind it. That one you can see, it's an exploding fireworks. So they burn. And the other thing that's a problem, and it's going to be continued to be one, is how dry it is down there. Some of the grasses are completely dried out by the 4th of July. And we're just waiting to have a disaster that's going to cause a fire all the way across the front. The houses on both sides of me are old wooden houses, easily going up in flames. I stand out there with both of my water supplies and both upstairs ready at all times. Unfortunately, I didn't catch the ones that hit my awning and my deck, but you can't stop them once they're there and started to burn. There's not much you can do. I did have the awning repaired. It was several hundred dollars. The deck I had replaced because I show one burn spot, but there were several there along the way there. And it really is not acceptable in terms of the behavior of the people or as an example of what a community should put up with. And I'm hoping that you will look at it very carefully and at least have enforcement of the existing regulations, if not consider something more effective in terms of limiting the number of fireworks that are available and are readily distributed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
The next item, public comment, Brenda Lowe.
Hi, Brenda Lowe, Oceano. I wanted to take a minute to talk about something not on the agenda, and obviously it has to do with the election coming up in 3 weeks. And I want to strongly support people voting yes on Measure A20. I feel it's very important, and I wanted to thank the members of the community for stepping up to support this. There have been lots of canvassing, lots of walking, many signs put up, and I just wanted to share something that's probably very naive of me not to expect this, but having not been involved in a lot of public campaigns or political activities, I'd been involved in getting permission and putting up signs where it was approved to have them, if I had permission. And there were at least 8 signs that a group of citizens and myself had gotten approval to put along Highway 1, Sanaga Street. And yesterday I drove by and every one of them was gone. Every one of them was gone. And I got out and walked the area. I did find one behind a bush and another one on another street. But it was really disconcerting because being involved in coming up with the helping small donors get money in to get publicity out for this, it was really disconcerting that people would resort to that. One, you might think vandalism or that kind of thing, but straight away, you know, that many. It was disconcerting to me, and I hope people will stick to merits of the measure or points against the measure and not resort to crap like that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment?
Good evening, I'm Julie Tacker, and I'd first like to speak to the President's reading of the top of your agenda where it says, persons wishing to speak on more than one item shall limit his or her remarks to a total of 6 minutes. This time may be allocated between items in 1 minute increments. Up to 3 minutes time limits may not be yielded or shared with other speakers. This is not in your bylaws, that the public is limited like this, and I think that to do this disenfranchises the public. It's you're telling the public we don't want to hear from you, and I think this language should be taken off of your agenda, and you should simply stick with the customary individual speakers are limited to a presentation of 3 minutes per item. So that I first wanted to speak to that. A question I had about the recent brownout at the fire station. Oceano actually pays for its fire service. It pays as part of the contract with Five Cities Fire Authority. And for the hours that you did not have service, I'd like to know if you are due a credit. And it's clearly, we hear all the time that Oceano is struggling for money, and that's fire money, and it should come back to Oceano to be used for fire. So I'd like you to ask your district legal counsel if that credit is available. And the last thing I wanted to just touch on, because I have a lot of experience in Los Osos, your general manager and the general manager before both said that Los Osos Community Services District, that the county took the Los Osos Community Services District's garbage franchise away from them? Absolutely not. That garbage franchise was sold to the county. So just when you are talking about your fire tax and using Los Osos as an example in any way, that is factually incorrect.
Any other public comment?
Hello, I'm Carl Kempton, Oceano. I would like to ask you to agendize the Blue Water Project instead of talking behind closed doors about it. We are a poor community, right? We know that, but we're water rich. And many of us are concerned that the other water entities are setting up to take what we have under another guise. So to clear up rumors and disinformation is, I think, for clarity, to have a public discussion with the public and have it agendized and have all of the documents that you're dealing with available to us to take a look at would serve the interest of Oceano. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any thank you.
Public comment?
Good evening, Charles Varney, Oceano. And I would like to echo Mr. Kempton's desire to have a Project Blue, or I'm not sure if I have the name right there, but the water recycling project, to have that agendized for the public meeting, and so we can get a more current update on really what's going on with it. And hope we can do that sooner than later while we still have some options. And then secondly, I'd like to echo the gentlewoman's comments about the fireworks. I understand that Oceano is the only place around that allows fireworks every day of the year, as long as they're safe and sane, and we know that they're unsafe and insane primarily. And the OCSD has authority over that, and I think it's time we look at eliminating fireworks from Oceano and the way it has increased in the last 5 years to just an unbelievable barrage for days at a time. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else have public comment? Okay, seeing none. Is there anything you'd want to comment on, any other public comment? The fireworks and the county. Have you gone to the sheriff's department?
I've gone to the sheriff's department. They have come out, chased people away, but they can't have someone there all the time.
Right.
And the safe and sane is, you know, obviously from the photograph you can see it's ridiculous. And they're huge, things like that. And so I'm not sure whether they buy them here, but even when they buy them here, those are out of hand. The sheriff did say that he is going to enforce more effectively this year. But you have enforcement regulations on the books. It's just that they have not been enforced.
Okay.
I believe, do we have our annual fireworks process kicking off in, when's it scheduled? March or April?
I think it's April, isn't it?
So maybe that would be an appropriate time to discuss the issue.
Okay.
I would suggest a bit before that, because that's when the permits come up. So,
you want to just come up to the microphone?
Yeah. That is part of the problem, that if we're selling fireworks here, it makes it sound like it's going to be okay. And even though you say they only sell safe and sane, well, I'm not really sure that's true, but it makes it look like we're accepting of everything. So it's a bit misleading to even have all of our fireworks stands here when no one else allows them.
All right. Excuse me, you've had your public comment, sir.
I'd like to address the fireworks.
It's over. Public comments.
Well, we have mortars being used, setting off fireworks in Oceano,
over,
and nobody does anything about it.
Public comments over. Okay, I think we'll move on.
I had a couple of questions related to the public comment. Could we remove this section that limits total speaker time throughout the meeting? So we don't want to be putting a limitation on public comment. I don't think that's actually been enforced at any rate.
It's never been enforced, and I was reading that. I read that and not that. So it's been on there forever. I don't know what, is it, if it's not in the bylaws. I mean, it's something we can, I guess.
So it doesn't have to be in the bylaws for it to be.
Doesn't have to be in the bylaws?
Yeah, for it to be enforced. However, it's up to your board whether you want it on there, and you could agendize a future item to discuss that.
Okay.
Can we talk about that now, or do we have to wait until future agenda items?
It has to be on the agenda. Future agenda items.
Okay. And then I also wonder, how does it work with the brownouts? Like if is it only the Oceano station that's ever browned out? Are other stations browned out too at times, and they just shuffle around who's covering, or how does that work?
So currently the funding formula, Oceano only pays for staffing of two, one full-time firefighter, whereas the other stations and communities, Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach, all have three staffing. So Oceano is paying less for the smaller staffing of this station. So when somebody is not available at this station, that's what's causing the brownouts. Now, with the amendment that was approved, it has a trigger of Measure A20. So if Measure A20 passes, then the funding formula switches from paying by staffing to paying by fire station. So if Measure A20 passes, then it would seem that if there was staffing shortfalls, it really becomes an operational issue for Five Cities Fire to determine which stations are browned out based on call volumes, etc.
Grover Fire Station has also been browned out in the past.
So.
Okay. That'll bring us up to item 9A, presentation and discussion of the California Voting Rights Act.
Okay. So tonight we have kind of a brief presentation by legal counsel, and we have a guest, distinguished doctor from Cal Poly, that's going to give us a presentation on the California Voting Rights Act. And what we're here to do tonight is, it's more of an educational session, so review and consider this presentation. But we're also asking for you to adopt a resolution to consider transitioning from at-large elections to some form of alternative representative elections. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to our legal counsel, and maybe Jeff, if you could just give a statement, why are we here?
President Austin, directors of the board, so this has been happening throughout the community, and I think you are aware of it. And communities have been responding to correspondence from various plaintiffs' attorneys demanding this type of change, and we're trying to get ahead of that. If you make a change in response to a letter from a party demanding the change, there is a $30,000 price tag statutorily attached to that. And so I'm not saying that we know all the answers today. We don't. There are questions, but we are trying to make a change. And I think that what I believe would be the intention of your board is that there are concerns that the way we currently do our at-large elections, which is meaning that the folks are elected from the entire jurisdiction for any seat. The concerns with that is that sometimes or oftentimes that the members of the board are not adequately reflecting the community as a whole. And I believe it would be the desire of your board, as it is, I think, with most boards, that your board reflects the community in all its respects, whether it's racial equality or political bent, all these types of ideas that you want to be a reflection of your community. So there is a movement, and there is a move throughout the county to shift from these at-large elections to alternatives, and I think that the consultant that you'll hear from tonight has helped and been a consultant to, I believe, Arroyo Grande, Atascadero, I believe Paso as well, in how these changes have made. So really what we're trying to do tonight is let you know what you're alternatives are, and then your board can hopefully be adequately informed to understand where you want to go from here.
So with that, I'll invite Dr. Michael Lattner to give a presentation. Dr. Lattner is a professor of political science at Cal Poly. He's a senior fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists for the Center for Science and Democracy, where he works to advance evidence-based electoral reforms. His research on redistricting has been cited by the U.S. Supreme Court in recent gerrymandering cases, and he's advised several city, regional, and statewide governments on electoral reforms, including the cities of Atascadero, San Luis Obispo, and Paso Robles. With that, Dr. Lattner.
Welcome. Thank you, Will. And I'd like to thank the community district officials for having the innovation to take action on this and give me an opportunity to talk to the public about what options you have. As your legal counsel mentioned, there's been a proliferation of lawsuits in California cities and special districts and school districts and many other advisory districts over the enforcement of the California Voting Rights Act. And the impetus built into the California Voting Rights Act has been to adopt district elections. That is, you assign voters to individual districts and you do away with at-large elections. The reason that that's been such a go-to remedy is that in the after the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Federal Voting Rights Act, and given the geographic conditions of segregation, particularly in the South, single-member districts were a remedy that worked, right? And so it's got a good reputation in history in the courts, and there's a lot of social science that backs up the properties of single-member district representation. We know its advantages as well as its disadvantages. And so one of the things I want to talk about tonight are to compare the pros and cons of what you get and what the alternatives are, because the while 50, 60 years ago, moving to a single-member district system certainly made sense, and today it still makes sense in certain contexts, it often doesn't. And indeed, being too quick to adopt any kind of reform without fully understanding the context within which it's operating can actually lead to very adverse effects. Indeed, could even make you vulnerable to a federal lawsuit, because you may be actually splitting the votes of protected classes under the Voting Rights Act. And so I'm going to be as brief as I can tonight in order to leave enough time, as much time as possible for questions. But I'm basically going to work through the various options that you have with any sort of electoral reform. And I'm going to be focusing on two mechanisms in particular. That's the number of seats per district or district magnitude. And so right now you've got an at-large electoral system. All of the members are elected district-wide. That can change. You can change the number of seats per district from the entire assembly down to one or something in between. And then the electoral formula is the other thing that matters the most in terms of how votes are actually translated into seats. The goal of all this and the goal of any electoral system should be fair representation. And by fair, I specifically mean that every voter who casts a vote, their vote should have equal weight. That's how the Supreme Court defines political equality under the 14th Amendment and the equal protection that is afforded all citizens under the 14th Amendment. And when that's violated, that specific violation is called vote dilution. That is, given certain rules in particular electoral contexts, some people's votes can count less than others. And there's a number of ways where that can happen. This is not the sort of violation of voting rights that we think of in terms of ballot access and eligibility, right? Whether or not someone gets to cast a vote, those types of discrimination have largely been prohibited and done away with. What we're talking about now is the effectiveness of one's vote. right? So whether or not my vote counts the same as someone else who happens to be of a different race or happens to vote for a different political party or something of that nature, right? So racially polarized voting is specifically the target of the California Voting Rights Act, which is modeled after the Federal Voting Rights Act. And the basic rules are that in a situation where you have racially polarized voting, that is, there is a racial or language minority that is protected under the Voting Rights Act, and they vote as a block, right? So there's not a lot of crossover voting between different racial groups. And whites in particular vote as a block as well, right? That's what defines racially polarized voting. If you have a situation like that, and then you have a third condition where the votes of the majority regularly defeat the candidate of preference for the minority voting bloc, that's where you have a violation of the California Voting Rights Act and the Federal Voting Rights Act. And the way that that happens is the amplification of the majority, which is not always actually even a majority in partisan gerrymandering cases, right? You can have a council, for example, that is insulated. So even if it doesn't always get a majority of the vote, it can control all of the seats by virtue of the electoral system. And I'll show you some examples of how that happens. That's a violation of the one person, one vote rule, and it's a violation of political equality. There are a lot of places where discrimination can happen. And as I said earlier, with regard to voter eligibility and ballot access, the early enforcement of the Voting Rights Act largely dealt with those sorts of violations. So literacy tests and poll taxes and the like. What we're talking about tonight has to do with the two top tiers there. That is the electoral formula, how votes are translated into seats, and then district magnitude and the number of seats per district. And those two things affect votes differently and distinctly, right? So whereas it is often, the conventional wisdom is that at large elections, like the way that the community district is elected, that they're bad for minority voters, and so the only alternative is district elections. But it's not actually the fact that you're all elected by the district as a whole that is causing potential discrimination. It is actually the electoral formula or the way that votes are actually counted. And so there are many at-large systems, indeed, across the world. There are many countries that don't even have districts at all, right? So if you look at a country like the Netherlands or like Israel, there are no districts. The entire parliament in the Netherlands, for example, is a single electoral district, and whatever percentage of votes a party gets, that's the percentage of seats that it gets in the parliament, right? And it's actually very favorable to minorities and to small parties and the like, right? So let's look at how this works. If we think about district magnitude or the number of seats per district on one axis and the electoral formula or the way that votes are counted on the other axis, we get an idea of the kind of the family of electoral systems. Thank you. Right, so looking up here, we've got multi-seat plurality voting, right? So you've got several seats per district. In this case, the entire community district is a single district with multiple seats, right? And you have typically either staggered elections or you elect all five seats at once. But the electoral rule is plurality. That is, whoever gets the most votes wins, right? Everyone understands that. It's a pretty intuitive system. But it is it's a multi-seat system, and it is traditionally opposed to the sort of single-seat systems that most larger elections that we have in the United States, like Congress and the Senate, for example, and the presidency even is technically a single-seat plurality district, right? And so there, the same formula, so whoever gets the most votes wins, right? But you're just changing the number of seats. And so in the House of Representatives, we have a 435-member House. That's the size of the assembly, equivalent to the five-seat assembly that we have here. But instead of having one election for 435 seats, we really have 435 little elections, right? So that's the difference between small and large district magnitudes. On the other axis here, we have how the votes get counted, right? So on one extreme, we have plurality formulas, which is whoever gets the most votes wins. So if you get 10 candidates running and they all split up the total votes and they get fairly equal vote shares of 10%, and whoever gets the 11 or 12%, right, they're going to get those seats. So there's no majority rule. It's a plurality rule. Whoever gets the most votes wins. As we move along this spectrum, we can require majority rule, right? So we can require that the winners receive a majority of the vote. We typically call that a runoff election, right? So in California, for example, we're all familiar with the primaries. So we have primaries, or we now have a jungle primary in California where all the candidates running for partisan office are in the same primary, which is coming up next month. And then the top two candidates go on to the November, we call it the general, but it's technically actually a runoff now, right? So regardless of what party they're in, if you're running for Congress or state assembly, you're required to win a majority of the vote, and having a two-person runoff guarantees a majority winner, right? We can go further and look at other different electoral formulas that either specifically limit the power of majorities to control all seats, allow voters to rank choice and numerically rank the candidates or the parties that they prefer in order of their preference. And in terms of the sort of information that you get out of an election, that's about the maximum amount of information that you can get, right? Because if you think about single seat plurality, right, it's sort of a rough approximation of what voters want. You get one vote, there's no rank order to it. You're just sort of saying yes for one candidate. It doesn't tell you anything about how voters feel about the rest of the candidates. It's a sort of low fidelity measure, right? Compared to a limited vote, right? You're forcing voters to make a single choice, but that choice is limited to, regardless of how many seats there are, every voter only gets one vote, right? So even in a three-seat or a five-seat election, every voter would only get one vote. And the reason that tends to help minority candidates is that if there is this situation where you've got a majority-minority voting block, right, even the majority, all those members only have one vote. So they only get to choose one candidate. Right? When we move to ranked choice voting, multi-seat ranked choice voting, the formula then comes in where you get actually a quota, and I'll show you how that works in just a second. So thinking about different types of coalitions, right? We often think of racial coalitions or partisan coalitions. The last time I gave this talk, I was in Paso, so I used wine and beer because that's something that most of us understand on the Central Coast. The basic idea here is, though, maybe for Oceano I should have done different seashells or something of that nature. But the basic idea is that people vote for different reasons, right? And people tend to vote alike for various reasons, but it's coalitions that try to seek power in councils and in assemblies and the like. And so in this case, we have six types of voters that are competing for three council seats. And so what I'm going to do is run you through a number of different electoral systems with the same voters, the same preferences, so that you can see how changing the district magnitude, the number of seats to be elected, or changing the electoral formula will actually change the outcome, even though voters' preferences don't change. Right? So we'll start with the current system. And if we think about voters being aligned geographically, we cut the district into little squares where people live in different regions. Maybe you've got some spatial congregation or a correlation with where folks live. But the basic idea behind block voting is that in a district magnitude of three, so we're electing three seats and the whole district is, the entire community district is a single district with three seats. Typically, the way this works, and this is true for general law cities as well, right? Every voter gets a number of votes equal to the number of seats being elected. And so in this case, every voter gets three votes, and the voters can allocate their votes however they want. They don't have to allocate all three votes, but they can. And so the question for voters becomes, okay, well, I've got my own group, so if I'm a Cabernet lover, I can give, you know, my vote to the Cabernet candidate running, but then who else do I support, right? So if you've got a majority of coalition, in this case, let's say Cabernet and Merlot drinkers, or, you know, they both like fairly un-eccentric wines, let's say, they're going to support each other, right? So the Merlot voters support the Cabernet candidate, the Cabernet candidate supports the Merlot voters, and they're going to allocate their votes in support of their coalition. We've got Tempranillo here that's also supporting the other red wine drinkers, but let's say for the sake of argument that rosé, which is, you know, one might think of as like a breakfast wine, but it's something that Cabernet and Merlot drinkers love, so they all support each other, even though the rosé folks don't really have a lot of support in and of themselves, right? But that coalition, those three groups, they can win every seat, right? The three groups. And that's true no matter how much support they get from Tempranillo drinkers or from beer lovers who are sort of left out in the cold, right? Even if they would have to get support from those bigger groups in order to win even one seat. And so this is the reason why this kind of electoral system is so susceptible to violation of the Voting Rights Act, because if there is a majority and if it votes as a bloc, they can control every seat. Right? They can win every seat, no matter how many seats there are, because every voter gets a number of votes equal to the number of seats. Right? That's the problem with this kind of electoral system, is that when there is polarized voting, right, that the majority can win, and it doesn't even have to be a majority, right? Notice that none of these groups actually have a majority of votes. It's just the largest plurality, and they vote as a bloc, and they can win every single seat. That's why this is a system that is generally not good for minority voting rights. Now, if we change just one thing, and we say, okay, well, instead of giving every voter three votes, we're going to move to a limited voting system. Right? And under limited voting, everyone gets one vote, regardless of how many seats are up for election. And the way that this works to limit the power of a plurality or a majority coalition is that even if you are a majority coalition and you're running three candidates to take those three seats, right, every voter only has one vote, so they've got to choose among the majority coalition, who do they support? Right? And so it makes it virtually impossible for a majority to sweep all the seats. And in this case, you can see that basically what you're doing is you're taking everyone's first preference. Right? That's what limited voting does. It says, which one candidate do you like the most? And in this case, now we get Tempranillo gets a seat, right? Because basically there are nine of them out of the 48 votes cast, and so they actually capture that second seat. Merlot is the second most popular group, right? They only vote for their folks. They get the third seat. But now you've broken up this coalition, right, where Cabernet and Merlot and Rosé can control everything. And indeed, Rosé has very little hope of doing much, because it's actually a very small group of voters who have Rosé as their first preference. I mean, who really likes Rosé as their first preference? Okay, so that's one way to curb the over-representation of a plurality or a majority coalition. The other way to typically do it, and this is what has been encouraged by the California Voting Rights Act, is to actually chop up a city or a district or a community service district or something into smaller districts, right? So what you do here, this is actually three districts, although one of these colors is not showing up very well. But you can carve out, right, a majority-minority district. That is, you look for, in this case, we're looking for beer lovers, right, because they don't ever win any seats. But if we carve the districts in sometimes a creative enough shape, right, which is where we get the term gerrymandering, we can actually carve out enough voters so that indeed the Firestone and the Barrel House lovers, they actually get one of those three seats, right? But you've got to, for one, voters need to be geographically concentrated. Otherwise, you're going to have even stranger-looking districts. And again, they have to vote as a block. Right? So there's a sort of other condition, an additional condition, that you need a certain level of geographic segregation or geographic concentration in order for this to actually enhance minority representation. Okay. The third change in electoral formula is one that has been increasingly popular in the state of California. Several cities have now signed on to and gotten an agreement from plaintiffs under threat of lawsuit from the California Voting Rights Act, and that's to move to a ranked choice voting scheme. This is actually a ballot that is used. There are 8 cities in the Bay Area now that use some form of ranked choice voting. As a result of the threat of lawsuit under the CVRA, 3 cities have now adopted a single transferable vote system. So you have multi-member districts, and you have ranked choice voting in the same way that you do in most of the Bay Area cities that actually use single-member districts with ranked choice voting. Right? So this would be a change in both the electoral formula. It would actually keep the district magnitude the same, so you'd still have your at-large elections. Ideally, though, under this kind of a system, what you want to do is increase the number of seats being contested. So rather than have staggered elections, you'd want all seats up at once, because the number of seats being contested, the more seats that there are, the lower the quota for representation. Right? So if you only have one seat up, so if you're moving to a single member district system, then the quota is 50% plus one, right? Majority rule. The more seats you have contested, the more you're dividing that quota, so that it takes either a 33% of the vote, or 20% of the vote, or 17% of, around 17% of the vote, a coalition can win a seat, is guaranteed a seat under a 5-seat single transferable vote election. Right? And the way that this basically works, this is a quick illustration. So you've got a quota, right? And your quota is set by an electoral formula where you're basically dividing all the number of votes cast by the number of seats you're electing, plus one, and then you add one vote to that. So in this case, for a 3-seat election, you need 25% of the vote to win a seat, right? You add one to that, so you need 13 votes out of the 48. And so let's say that in the first round of voting, right, all voters order their ballots, 1 through 5. Let's say there's 5 candidates running, or there's 6 candidates running in this case. And in order to win a seat, you got to get those 13 votes. In the first round, right, Cabernet is the biggest group. They win that first seat. Right? They're guaranteed the first seat because they're the largest group. Now, the way that the ranking works is that if they win with more than 13 votes, they have surplus votes. And those surplus votes actually get reallocated at a reduced value to whoever the second choice candidates are. And so in this case, again, let's say it's the majority coalition. So you got 3 going to Merlot and 1 going to Rosé. In the second round, nobody's got 13 votes, right? So no one makes the quota. So under that situation, what you do is you eliminate the least popular candidate, right? They are eliminated, and their second place votes then get reallocated, which in this case, again, we're sticking with this Cabernet Merlot Rosé coalition. So let's say all of Rosé's votes go up to Merlot. In the third round, right, then you actually get Merlot wins the second seat. And so the largest coalitions are always going to win the most seats, right? Because if everyone's vote is counted equally, they're going to have the most seats. But notice that we go to the fourth round, right? So now we've got a transfer, let's say, to Tempranillo, the third place votes. And you've got the least popular candidate still remaining eliminated, right? That's the Barrel House folks. And, of course, their votes are going to go to the Firestone folks. And once you get to just 2 candidates, well, then you just take, if you've got 1 seat left, you take whoever's got the most votes, right? And so the way that this system works is very simple from the perspective of the voter, because they just rank their choices. And then the rounds are counted, and eventually a winner is determined for every one of the 3 seats, right? One example of this in real life actually just happened this weekend. So the country of Ireland uses the single transferable vote. They've used it for about 100 years, and they just use it over the weekend. It's this whole round counting part is actually quite a big public event, so they do it on TV with the local registrars of voters, and they pull the ballots out of old wooden boxes, and they count them and then reallocate the votes. You don't have to do it that way. It's probably much better to do it by a computer using fractional votes, and it's a lot faster. But it's kind of a public event. But that's the basic idea behind the single transferable vote. And it is probably the single fairest system in terms of ensuring minority representation without having to move to any kind of geographic separation of a district or an assembly. Moreover, I would add that if there is some kind of polarized voting, right? So whatever the division is within a given constituency, let's say it's pro-growth or anti-growth or it's fireworks or something, that whatever it is that animates the community, right? If there is a majority and a minority that are divided over that particular issue, it's going to show up here, right? It's going to show up because the candidates that if there is a majority, they're not going to be able to control every seat unless they have, you know, like an 80% majority you need a 75% majority or more to control all these seats. And so it doesn't limit the sorts of social and political divisions, partisan or otherwise, on a given in a given assembly or a district. And so I think one of the nicer properties about this is that when you move to single districts, it tends to ossify those geographies. And if you draw those districts according to race, you're sort of essentializing race as a division within your community. Or if it's partisan, you're, again, we all know what partisan gerrymandering looks like, and we know how that works. And it's not good, right? And so this is a more fluid way of paying attention to the value of individual votes, rather than assigning people a district, and in many ways assigning them an identity, right, and a politics. So it's something that has been catching on, and so that's why I wanted to spend a little more time talking about it. But ultimately, whatever you choose, whether you choose a single district system or some other change in electoral formula, my advice is to be careful for unintended consequences. Right. Think through your decision and how it affects the way that your assembly works, because all of these decisions have consequences in terms of the way that politics is expressed and the way that representation works. Single member districts tend to be less competitive, right? You get an incumbent typically that controls a lot of votes in a single member district system. You tend to have lower turnout. There tends to be less participation. But again, depending on the context, that might be the right choice. If you've got some, you know, very serious racially polarized voting and you've got deep geographic segregation, it might be a reasonable alternative. It certainly has been, you know, throughout a lot of cities in the United States. And as you go up in scale, the argument for districts makes more sense. I think it makes much less sense when we're looking at fairly small communities. But that's basically the landscape, right? So you've got two things you can play with. You can tinker with district magnitude. You can tinker with the electoral formula. They both affect voters and representation in very different and distinct ways. And so keep that in mind when you're thinking about what kind of representation you're looking for. And ultimately, I would just conclude by saying that the normative concern should always be fair representation. You're always looking, ultimately, the best that we can do as a democracy is to ensure that every voter has an equally weighted vote. And I'd love to take questions. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay.
I have questions. I'm sure you have questions.
I was wondering if we could get the presentation on our website. So some of these links are kind of long for people to type in. It would be good to just be able to click in there.
plenty of additional information that I'm happy to provide if you're looking for research on specific types of electoral systems or their consequences. There's a great deal of research out there.
Thank you. That was very informative.
Thank you. Yeah, I was just a couple of questions, if I could read them. You were talking about the ranking where all five, say, on this board, all five people were up at the same time.
Right.
Wouldn't there be a really, I can see if all five of us are replaced at one time, the learning curve and institutional memory, it might be good to replace everybody. I'm not questioning that. But at the same time, it would take several months to even get up to an operational speed with the board.
Yeah, that's...
You have training you have to go to and...
That is a potential trade-off, right? The reason that we have staggered elections is is just for that sort of continuity. Of course, the more... there's a trade-off there, right, in terms of you get continuity, but at the expense of public accountability. And so if something happens and the public changes its perception and wants to change the whole board, they don't have the ability to do so.
And if I could jump in here, Vice President, the CSD law doesn't allow for the five members. It has to be staggered election. So that's kind of a constraint that we have to work within.
Yeah. And another question, which system would generate, do you have an opinion on which system would generate the most voter turnout? Because that's a real challenge here.
Yeah, it's a good question, especially given the low level of information that community districts that voters have access to, right? I mean, so if you think about voter turnout is driven fundamentally by information, right? So you're going to get high turnout when there's a presidential race at the top of the ticket. You're going to get less turnout when it's just Congress. And you're going to get less turnout if you have a community district election that's on an off month or something like that, where it doesn't even coincide with other state elections. So there are things that matter a lot more than the electoral system that determine turnout. Now, on average, holding all that equal, the system that gives voters the most power tends to increase turnout. So more competitive, a system no system can guarantee competition, but systems that tend to be more competitive, systems that encourage more candidate entry, tend to be more competitive, and more competitive elections increase turnout.
Okay. Do both options avoid the lawsuit?
Well, in California, no option guarantees you freedom from a lawsuit. But I would say that the fact that you're even entertaining the question before you've been served is a very strong response on your part, because it shows that you're already looking. And so I think with regard to what's the best way to avoid a lawsuit, as long as is a judge, and increasingly we've seen this with several cities in Southern California in particular, if a letter does come and you can show publicly that you've already begun taking action, that's a big deal, because you're showing that, one, the whatever information that they use to marshal using past elections has much less credibility, because you're already looking at changing your electoral system. And so it certainly, at a minimum, it buys you time. In a best-case scenario, they've got nothing to work with.
And do you have any other small communities that, like ours, that you might compare it to?
In terms of an analysis, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of communities that are in a similar situation. There are similar sized school districts that are already faced suits, for example.
Is there any choice that's more prevalent?
Well, I mean, the most prevalent response has been to just adopt districts. And the reason for that is because in the few cities that have tried to fight this, they've lost. And Palmdale being the one that everyone looks to. So Palmdale fought one of these lawsuits from Kevin Shankman who's a Southern California attorney, who's been submitting a lot of these letters. And rather than it just being a, you know, a $30,000 problem plus $30,000 or $50,000 for the districting, they end up paying multiple $1 million in damages. And so essentially what that has done for many city attorneys is to scare them into quickly adopting district elections. And that's understandable, right? I mean, districts and assembly groups are strapped for money, but if you don't do it right, you could actually make yourself more vulnerable. And I think that that's something that's underappreciated.
Has there been any effort by a reverse kind of suit? I'm thinking people charging one man, one vote, social engineering, that kind of thing. Have there been any? I'm looking at countering with another counter, sort of, that
yes.
We might be liable to run into buzzsaws from both sides.
There have been. There is currently a suit that is on appeal in Poway. It's a city in San Diego County, and they're essentially making the claim that the whole California Voting Rights Act is unconstitutional. Right? They may be pressing their luck a little bit, but they're making a strong claim. Other cities, though, have Huntington Beach, for example, received the same letter, and they basically called their bluff and said, "Look, if you know, there's no racially polarized voting here, and there's no way that you could meaningfully make a district that would." Enhance minority representation anyway, so they told them, in the fashion of good beach cities, they told them to go pound sand.
And one last question. If we had to, well, I would support forming districts, actually, but I mean, do we get to stall until after the next census? Because it makes no sense to me to start making districts until we have a better count.
Not necessarily. So some of these suits, so Paso, for example, has decided to, at least for one election cycle for 2020, to adopt district elections, and then they're going to move to do something else so that they don't have to pay again to redistrict. So that's, I mean, one of the downsides of the districting plan is that you're going to have to pay a demographer to district your district every 10 years at a minimum.
Well, but it would be 1 year.
In the case of Paso, yeah, they're going to have one election, and then they're going to have to redistrict again. But what they're hoping to do is to move to an alternative system so they don't have to do that.
Paso's got a lot more money than Oceano has.
I would imagine so.
I mean, I don't want to have to pay $30,000 to redistrict and come back in a year and a half and pay $30,000 to redistrict. We don't have that kind of money.
Well, indeed, and you shouldn't have to redistrict at all. So I think there are a number of other sort of negative externalities that come with a really small community district like this trying to carve itself into districts.
Yeah, what do we got?
President Austin, if I may just
yes.
Chime in for a moment. I think that where we are today is that we want to get ahead of this, and we want to get ahead of receiving a letter that comes with a $30,000 price tag, that $30,000 matters to this board. So there may not be any guaranteed effort we can do today. We're trying to bring this forward so that we can show the community or show a judge, if we receive this type of letter, that you've already taken action in some regard to ensure that there is a change, some meaningful change made, that your board going forward reflects the community. And so that's why we felt it was important to bring this to your board for consideration as quickly as possible.
May I ask, what is the CSD law you said that requires staggered elections?
So the government code, I think it's 61000, I'll find it for you, just identifies how elections are handled for community services districts, and it calls for staggered elections of three, and community services districts have five-person boards with staggered elections of three and then two.
So that would have to be changed if we wanted to have all five seats up. Do you know if anybody's talking about changing that law because of this issue?
I don't know of anybody that's talking about changing it. And my assumption is that it's to keep that type of continuity that I think President Austin or Vice President White was talking about, so that the board doesn't...
It seems to me, even if all five seats were up, it's unlikely that at least a couple people wouldn't be reelected, but...
In a small community like this, you're probably right, yeah. But I have known of no efforts to make a legislative amendment.
Okay, if you could send me that site, that would be great.
I will.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Lattner.
Thank you.
And I'm going to open this to public comment now. Anyone have public comment?
Good evening, Ms. Austin, board members. My name is Jeff Edwards, and I would respectfully submit that the OCSD is a case study, really, in racially polarized voting. And as such, your district is vulnerable, I think. But the good news is that the timing is perfect, really. There is a narrow window to move forward and move away from the at-large format. And it appears that most of the staff report was prepared by your general manager and didn't have a lot of legal input. There is a bit of literature. The League of California Cities prepared the California Voting Rights Act, Recent Legislation and Litigation Outcomes. That was published in 2018. And raises a number of very important points. And probably the most important point is the idea of safe harbor. And if you look at what safe harbor is, it's what you're interested in. This district wants to be in the safe harbor. And to do that, you need to keep it simple and go with the single district, single candidate voting format. In doing so, you have some timelines to act. After you pass your resolution, you have 90 days before anybody could file any kind of demand letter. And then if they do file a demand letter, you have another 90 days before you would be subject to any litigation. And again, I think the timing is perfect, and I'll outline a little bit of that for you. I think your resolution that's in the packet can be strengthened to provide more specificity and an actual timeline. In doing so, that resolution will provide you with a shield. Otherwise, and as it's currently written, I don't think it will. So at your next meeting, you could come back and approve a strengthened resolution. It'll set a 90-day clock in motion. Mm-hmm. The census data is being compiled as we speak, and that data should be available sometime in April. At that point, you could hire a demographer to prepare your boundaries. And then there's a requirement under the law that you come back and have at least two public hearings to discuss the ramifications. And then, frankly, you're set up for the November 3rd election. You're ready to go. You have three seats that are up: Rapogle, Gibson, and Austin. The districts will be formed. They will fall within districts, and you're going to have three new members that, in my view, will be more representative of this community. So I don't think you can afford to wait. I think it's important that you move forward. And again, the resolution that you're going to consider tonight, I think, needs to be sent back for additional work with input from legal counsel. And as I mentioned, I would not include, which is what's in there now, the idea of transitioning from at-large elections to an alternative representative election method. You do not, in my opinion, want to have anything to do, and again, with all due deference to your presenter tonight, I don't think you want anything to do with the alternative election or representative election. So those are my comments. I think there's a very tight timeline, but if you subscribe to that timeline, you will not be vulnerable to any litigation. Thank you.
Any other public comment?
Julie Tacker, and I think the conversation is really exciting. I think going to districts, looking at your board makeup today, and this is not to be disrespectful at all. In fact, it's complimentary in that Linda Austin, Shirley Gibson, and Karen White are well known in the community. If you shrink those districts that you all are in, or there are other districts that you're not on that on their ballot, people might be willing to run because they don't want to compete with the name recognition that you have. And I think that your name on the same ballot is a deterrent for people to run. So I think it's kind of exciting. You're going to see new faces with new ideas representing their interests in your small community.
Any other public comment? Okay, seeing none, and I'll bring it back to the board.
Could Mr. Minery address some of Jeff's points about the resolution? Does it need to have a timeline in it, or need to be strengthened somehow in order to protect us, as he outlined?
So as far as strengthening the resolution to ensure that you are in a safe harbor, I think is what you're referring to. And so I think the point tonight is between the conversations that your general manager and Mr. Lattner and I had just trying to understand this, the first point that we wanted to do is bring you what your options are. And so the point of the resolution tonight is that if, in fact, you receive a letter demanding some sort of a change, we can have a very clear defense to the point that we are already ahead of it. And so any change your board makes is not in response to a letter that comes with a $30,000 price tag. It's the concept that you were already had. And so I think that to the extent you want to change or resolve, or if your board determines to go with a different route or with a by district amount approach, maybe then we will have a further resolution when your board is ready. But right now, I think the point is we just want to buttress our argument as best as we possibly can until your board had the opportunity to understand the options that are out there.
Well, and how do we determine minority? Is that based just on race or senior citizens or?
Perhaps Mr. Dr. Lattner would like to respond to this based on his experience.
Thank you.
Sure. The protections under the California Voting Rights Act are based solely on race. So they're based on the census categories of identification with one or more races, Latino, Hispanic as a separate category, and then language minorities as well.
Thank you.
If I might ask one more question, Dr. Lattner, how would it work if we went to five districts but we only have three seats open in the November election?
So you would have that would be similar to the scenario that that I showed. If you had a three-seat election, any group with 25% of the vote would be guaranteed a seat. So if
there'd be five districts, right?
Right.
But then you'd have to pick three of them that would be voting for the three seats that are open.
Nothing would change in terms of the current staggered election cycle, right? You'd stick with the two and three. The only thing you would change is how the votes are counted. So you'd still maintain your at-large election system if you wanted to use a transferable method as opposed to moving to districts. Is that?
No, if we had districts, we divide right. The community up into five districts.
Yeah, then
But there's only three seats that are open. Right. So do you just pick, okay, district 1, 2, and 3? Those are going to.
Yep, or 1, 3, and 5, 2, and 4. That's usually the way it's done.
So how do communities generally decide which ones to pick? Because you could totally who is going to be.
Well,
able
let's
to
say,
vote
so in the example raised, right, if you went to district elections before November, then whichever three seats were up, those would be the three districts that citizens would have a vote in, and citizens outside of those districts wouldn't get a vote.
Except you're assuming that the districts would be drawn so that they have one of those incumbents in them?
That's what I'm assuming. That's the goal, right? Or
well,
it depends, right? I mean, that could be very hard to do.
Our situation right now is that two members, they're not both up in this election, mm-hmm. but two people live next to each other in the same community. So
right.
I don't think there's any way you could draw a district that
then that means
it's separate for each.
Well, then
one
you
of
run
those.
Against yeah. So typically, the way that works is the two incumbents would end up running against one another. One would win, and then a new cycle starts.
Oh. Well, but right? if one of them was up this year and one of them wasn't, then that person wouldn't be allowed to run, right?
That's right. Well, if that person doesn't live in their district, then they're out. That's right.
My term's not up.
Never. Okay.
Okay, here we
go. Yeah, let's
get heading into
from the room.
I mean, you'd still, so I guess the, if you both lived in the same district, anyone, so you could run as an incumbent in that district, right? Let's say that you're, but you would have to then vacate the seat that you're currently sitting in, right? It would be as if someone was running for a different seat. So someone who's a governor runs for president or something like that. So it would, you know, those things have to get worked out.
It's complicated.
Indeed.
It is complicated. And the who does the districting? Who does the actual?
So you would hire a demographer that would draw the lines. And I think from what I understand is if there's five existing board members, they try to draw the districts so that those five would end up in one of the five districts. Now, how they would handle if they live right next door to each other, I don't know.
Wouldn't that be gerrymandering in the worst kind of way?
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't support that. I mean, if I'm bounced, I wouldn't support that. Because that's one of the things that I hate worse than anything about many states in the United States is that gerrymandering that keeps people from having a voice. You know? So if we twist and turn Oceana, what are we accomplishing?
I think the ranked choice voting is a lot simpler and easier to implement, but like we don't need to decide it at this point, right?
It's
need to decide that we want to move forward with
you
something.
Don't need to decide it. You just need to decide you are the resolution is simply just to make to make a change to make sure that there is fair representation on this board, however you decide to do it. I will say that I know your general manager has spoken with the county clerk recorder, Tommy Gong, because it will take some sort of software update. But to be honest, it appears that this type of ranked choice, maybe in smaller districts, is gaining some traction as an alternative to doing exactly what you're talking about, that do you draw lines in odd ways in an attempt to be fair but then unfair. We are in correspondence with Tommy Gong about how this could potentially be an avenue moving forward.
And the cost of dividing, you know, having the districts divided.
So I spoke to Tommy Gong yesterday, and so there's going to be costs regardless of which way you go. Mm-hmm. So there's the cost of districting, which you would have to go through, which from talking to Grover Beach, they're thinking it's between $30,000 and $40,000 to do the districting. They also were served with a letter, so they had to pay $30,000 in legal fees. So the whole effort's costing them about $70,000 to $75,000 to district. They're waiting until after the census is done so that they don't have to redraw the district in a year. Of course, it makes more sense for a larger city to draw districts than a smaller community, perhaps. But the other alternative voting methods that Dr. Lattner talked about require the clerk recorder doesn't have the software currently to do that type of voting. He could purchase it, and he indicated it was $350,000 and an annual $70,000 licensing fee. So I'm doubtful that the county will ante up that money, but if there was a coalition of cities and special districts that could perhaps go in together, if they were going to move in this direction, it could be broken up that way. So there's a lot of unknowns as to how that would be funded. I've encouraged him to go to the state level, because obviously this isn't a San Luis Obispo County issue, it's a state issue, and all of them should be facing this issue, and you know, perhaps there's opportunity for the state to come up with funding to implement these systems. But again, that's that hasn't really started from what I understand. So regardless of which way you go, it's going to be an expense.
But the district, the single district, is the only way to avoid lawsuits, correct? That would ensure that you're safe and you won't be sued?
To go into this, to make a resolution that you are going to go into by district, mm-hmm. which is drawing lines for five separate districts, it is my understanding that is the safest route. However, there are communities that are now going with this ranked choice mm-hmm. other option. And
but if you're still open for liability and it's complicated or people don't understand it.
And that's why this is being brought to your board to weigh these choices, and it will be coming up with other small district boards too. Now, many agencies have just simply said we're going to draw lines. And what we have learned is that they do draw the line, the demographer will draw the lines in a manner to keep the sitting board within each district. And so I think the $30,000 fee is one thing. I think overall your board should be thinking, understanding that there's potential risk by doing a different route, but there are other communities going this other way, and really what you are trying to do is, in the spirit of the Voters' Rights Act, ensure that there's a fair reflection, that the board is a fair reflection of your mm-hmm. community. And it appears
but
that maybe
it's more costly, right? You said it was more costly because of the software?
Well, we don't know that yet, because we don't know what kind of in a lot of ways it's less costly, because you don't have to spend $20,000 or $25,000 on a demographer to draw lines. So this is not, it's not an easy choice right now, and it's a moving, shifting landscape. So we're trying to give you the information as best as we can, but there is unknowns.
Yeah. Okay, so any other comments from the board?
I move we adopt a resolution to consider transitioning from at-large elections to alternative representative elections.
Second. Is this the resolution here?
Yeah.
Okay. May we have a roll call, please?
Director Apogle?
Yes.
Vice President White?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
President Alston?
Yes. Okay. So now we will move on to, let's see, we switched around, item 9B. Not B.
Thank you.
Thank you. Where am I here? 9C. Thank you, Dr. Lattner. Good night. Okay, you ready?
All right. President Austin, members of the board, item 9C. So this is an introduction of amendments to the district bylaws, and an opportunity for your board to give direction as you deem appropriate. And really the genesis of this was recent board discussions regarding committee assignments and various committees, and which ones are paid and which ones perhaps aren't. And it was just not clear in the bylaws what committees would actually be paid committees and which ones wouldn't be. So tonight's item is an attempt to clarify which committee assignments are paid or not, and some various other recommendations to make the district's business run smoother. So I thought I'd just go through a brief summary of the recommended changes. You have a red line strikeout version of the bylaws that has been prepared. The first item that you'll want to consider is a recommendation to move from 2 meetings a month to 1 meeting a month. And that's something that you have discussed in the past and were generally supportive of, but it was decided that to wait until after the fire tax issue was resolved. And at this point, the fire tax issue is on the ballot, so this is an appropriate time to bring that discussion back up. A lot of the items that we present are repetitive in nature. So it's a matter of, I don't think, you know, it's a matter of the business that this district conducts. Do we need to meet twice a month, or could we go to once a month? We've seen the county have the same discussion. They used to meet 4 times a month. They moved to twice a month. The Board of Trustees that I sat on at the county for pension, we met monthly. We decided to go less often than monthly. So it's a good process to go through to determine workload. It helps staff be more efficient moving to fewer meetings. Yes, it does save a little bit of money, but that's not really the purpose of the change, although it's a benefit. So that's one item that you'll want to consider and determine whether you want to move to 1 meeting per month. Related to that would be the adjournment time. Right now the bylaws state that you have to make a motion to go past 9:30. Obviously moving to less often meetings, the length of the meetings might become longer. So just by way of comparison, over the last 3 months, we've had 1 regular meeting each of the last 3 months, November, December, in January. And so I think the average length of those meetings was, I had that somewhere. No, I think 2 hours and 53 minutes, if my recollection is correct. So I would say 3 hours has been the last 3 months of meeting once a month. So that gives you an idea of what it might look like moving forward as far as how long the meetings are. So whether or not you want to change the adjournment time from 9:30 to something else, it doesn't seem like you have to, but you may want to consider it. There's also been some language in bylaws 3.2 and 3.5 to kind of make a distinction between standing committees and ad hoc committees. Bylaw 4.3, this is something that came up. Currently, the bylaws require staff to record, if available, the general residence of the speakers that come in public comment to speak, and whether they are in for or against whatever is being discussed. And so we had staff go back for the minutes prior and redo the minutes to reflect that. It took them, I think, an extra couple hours to do that. So with the fact that anyone could get and see the meetings on video, it doesn't seem like we need to be that detailed with our minutes. So that, thus the recommendation to eliminate that language from the bylaws. And finally, bylaw 8.1 regarding compensation. We're not reducing the amount of compensation. It stays at $100 per month for meetings. But when it comes to committees, which currently is $50 per month, it would increase it to $100, and it would eliminate which committee is, it would be regardless of which committee or assignment you're given, and that was an attempt to try to equalize it so that no one could say, well, I want to be on this committee because it's paid, or this one, I'm put on this because it's not paid. This makes it across the board, but it does recommend capping it at $100 per month, regardless to how many meetings are attended. But you would have to attend at least one to get that $100 compensation. So those are the suggested changes to the bylaws, and I'm willing to answer questions or leave it up to you to discuss, get public comment, and provide direction.
I think what we should do is have public comment, and then we can go through each one by one. Go ahead and do public comment.
I think maybe we could have board discussion before public comment, like we usually do.
That's okay. So did you have something you wanted to...
First I was wondering if you'd updated the cost savings estimate. We had some email correspondence today, and you had based it on eliminating 12 meetings.
Right, so the
rather
cost,
than 10.
Cost savings were based on 12 meetings, and that's based on the fact that this is a change to the bylaws. So changing from what the bylaws currently say to what the bylaws would say, the cost savings is $27,000. Now, if that's $27,000 in reality, who knows? We could call 12 special meetings over the next year, and there would be no savings. So it's just an estimate. And that's one thing that I forgot to mention. Moving to one meeting a month would in no way hinder your ability to call a special meeting if the workload required it or if something came up. So we could always have a special meeting and even have it on the same second or fourth Wednesday of the month that we usually meet if necessary.
So I just want to point out that normally we only meet once in November and December, so the savings would really be based on eliminating 10 meetings and not 12. But I would prefer to see us keep it at 2 meetings per month, and then if we don't need a second meeting in the month, cancel it, rather than say that we would have a special meeting if we need it, because the public doesn't get as much notice of a special meeting. They only get 24 hours versus 72, and we want to make sure that public participation is maintained. I have to disagree with staff's assertion that we don't have a lot still on our plate coming up, because if the fire tax fails, then we're going to have to select an alternative, and there's going to be a lot of work involved with that if we want to set up an independent fire station, if we want to divest of fire and emergency services. There's going to be a lot of things for this board to consider related to that. There's a decision on whether or not to participate in the Central Coast Blue Water Recycling Project, and I would suggest that the board consider at the same time looking at our entire water portfolio and setting the direction for Oceano's water supplies going into the future. So we still have a lot of work to do on this. And having only one meeting a month, and I went back a little farther than the last few meetings, the meetings seem to run from 2 to 4 hours. So if we're covering the same amount of work but only in one meeting a month, it could be running from 4 to 8 hours, meaning we'd be going to 10 p.m. or midnight sometimes. And we can't ask the public to participate in meetings that are such a marathon and last until late in the night. So that's what I think about eliminating a meeting. I would rather see us cancel meetings that we don't need than say right off the bat we're only going to do one a month. And Madam President, maybe it makes sense to discuss these changes one at a time.
That's what we're going to do.
Okay.
I like the one meeting as long as we have the potential to do a special meeting. And as far as our water portfolio, we talk about that almost every meeting. So I don't think we, you know, we already have long-range plans.
I'd like it to stay the same. I don't like really long meetings like at 9 o'clock. I'd like to be home by 9:15. Sometimes when they drag on long, I notice it's like the public leaves a little bit before 9, it's all empty. And most people can't make it for the special meetings because of the fact that they're earlier on in the day. So that's another thing. And I also have to agree with Cynthia with all the fire stuff and whether it passes or doesn't pass. I think the community needs to be assured, educated, informed, and we need to figure out what we want to do, what best, you know, for the interest of Oceano. That's my opinion.
Well, I'm going to say I do not want any meetings past 9:30 because I don't think we get anything done that late. Everybody's tired. So I would be against, you know, I like to leave that the way it was. As for the one meeting a month, you say we could have a special meeting, say if that the meeting we have on the 2nd, if we know we're going to, we could announce then there would be another meeting, right, like our usual meeting, instead of calling it just the short term. Unless they're, you know, in the,
you can call a special meeting with, it just has to be a minimum 24-hour notice, but you could do it 72 hours like we normally do.
And we don't have to implement this. We can pick a date, right, once the fire tax and all of that is resolved?
You could make it effective a certain date.
I'm torn. I would like one meeting a month from this cost saving. And, you know, we talked about it last year and we started to do it last year and then we got busy. And I think what we probably would end up with one way or the other is, like, we know November and December are one meeting. We know we're going to need two meetings ahead of doing the budget. I'm sure that'll take a couple of meetings. And it's true, whatever happens to fire. I would like to have one meeting a month, but I think we're going to need two. It's sitting here. Mm-hmm. I would, and I don't know whether we start with February and March. I mean, this is February, March, and April. Looking into the budget with two meetings, and then once we come into the summertime, we just cancel those meetings where we don't have as much to do. Because it seems that's my experience, that there are certain months that there just isn't much going on. Everything is in the hands of staff, and there's not much policy or stuff for us to do.
What big projects, as general manager, do you see coming up this year?
So, as Director Replogle mentioned, we have the election coming up, and either way, we're going to have work to do on the fire tax. If it passes, we have to do our administrative work to actually get it on the tax roll. If it doesn't pass, then we're going to have to determine what is our plan B on fire. So, I would say fire is obviously first priority. Another high priority is our water rates. It'll be 5 years since the last water rate increase, and we need to do that again to have a Prop 218 election. So that's a pretty heavy work effort on staff's part. Not so much, I mean, we'll have public meetings, we'll probably have a workshop, it's specified in Prop 218 how often you need to meet, and so that will be a big work effort. And there was a third one that I'm thinking of, but it left my mind. So we always have work to do is the point. So But what I'm hearing is I think there's a consensus to keep it at two meetings. And then if we...
What if we revisited, say, in April, May? I think it was sounded...
July. After July.
Well, I think we can always cancel meetings without changing the bylaws. If we don't need to have them.
Then would you still have to prepare for the meeting and then we cancel it? Or we just cancel it before we even... before you have to prepare for it, right? We can cancel it a week after.
Yeah, if we didn't have anything significant coming up.
You can just say, like, 2 weeks ahead of time, this next meeting's canceled.
Right.
As long as we're not in the place of just trying to jam a lot of stuff into one meeting that's going to end up being 5 hours.
I don't like meeting past 9 o'clock either.
Yeah, so...
And I hate to see that controlling. I hate to see that controlling... Because we can always extend it. You know, you proposed making some changes with that. The time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, did you say it correctly, Karen White?
Is that the board consensus? We'll stay at two meetings?
For the time being.
Mm-hmm. For the time being.
Revisit it. I like the idea of one in the summer because usually we are pretty, and then people can vacation, like starting in June, July, August.
And that really... Bylaw 2.12 will keep that. I think I added some language, though.
Yeah.
Oh, I added some language on what vote of the board.
Adjourned at 9:30?
Yeah.
Maybe disregarded? It's been,
So before it said 2/3, which makes it a little bit heavy of a lift to go past 9:30. Do you want to keep that language, or do you want to move it to a majority of the board as
majority
was
of the
suggested?
Board. Yeah,
majority's fine. Yeah, go ahead and leave that.
I don't think I'm the only one smelling smoke here, so anybody?
Yeah, I smell smoke, too. They're probably neighbors barbecuing.
It's getting a little heavy.
Or maybe it's the fire department barbecue.
Probably it's barbecue smell, I think.
Maybe they're practicing over there.
Smells like food.
Smells like charcoal.
Smells like charcoal.
Okay, let's go on. So are we going to go through each one of these before public comment about it?
What do you think?
However you want to do it.
Because we're kind of like making our decisions now before public comment. So I wonder if we should have public comment. Let's go ahead and do public comment, and then we'll go through these one by one. So are there any public comment on this? I have a slip from Mr. Eugene Flores.
Thank you, members of the board. I am Eugene Flores. I am an Oceano property owner and resident, property owner since 1978. So thank you for all of your and your predecessors' work in running this organization. I turn on the tap, I get water. On certain days, garbage comes, it gets picked up. I'm pretty happy. In regards to your bylaws, I have some recommendations and some comments. I was pleased to hear comment right now from the members of the board in keeping the 2 day a month and consideration of canceling a meeting if there are not enough to present a full meeting. Having worked in government operations, I know that a lot of staff preparation in terms of a meeting is a key element here. You save some time and you save some staff stress. That's your item for 2.1. It's a possibility, or let me offer a suggestion. It is possible if you have a large agenda, you might split it over 2 days. It's a meeting over 2 days, agendized over 2 days. That was your 2.1 bylaw. 3.5, ad hoc committee. In the language, there's no mention of the number of members on any ad hoc committee. I don't know what you've done in the past. I suggest an odd number like three so that there's an opportunity for a minority view or report on whatever the ad hoc committee's recommendations might happen to be. Item 3.6 on committee assignments. I'm baffled. There is no current language in the bylaws that describe the intent of committee assignments by this board to be fair or representative of elected members' requests or specialties such as knowledge or interest. And also, there is no language in this section at 3.6 regarding the minimum number of committees or the maximum that any elected member may be assigned. So given the recent action of this board, I actually find it reprehensible that a member would not be allowed to be on a committee or that actions would be taken to specifically eliminate anyone. It removes the representative portion of our representative democracy. Section 8.1, 8.2, and 8.3. You already mentioned that no member shall be paid more than $100 a day or $600 a month. I'm not quite sure where the $27,000 comes, unless it was not stated that it's coming from savings from not paying members to attend meetings. $600 a month max, $7,200 a year. You're not getting rich at this job. I acknowledge that. So I applaud the whole system for looking to be financially responsible, but at the same time, you should be compensated, and it's already listed that no one should get more than that, than $600 a month. So removing the consideration to minimize the amount of money per your time, I think, does you an injustice. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other comment?
Good evening, Jeff Edwards. It appears that Napomo, Cambria, and Templeton CSDs all retain the two meetings per month, and I'd encourage you to do that. Perhaps until you get caught up, you only need to look at your list of future agenda items to really understand the work that you do have. And you mentioned, or water portfolio was mentioned, and I would submit to the board that there's quite a bit to talk about. You've heard about the Central Coast Blue project and some of the issues there. If you followed the Board of Supervisors recently, you would know that this county is starting to review their unallocated entitlement of state project water, and that's going to be a big deal to a subcontractor like Oceano. There's excess pipeline capacity that is available, Lopez contract amendments. Your own CIP list, excuse me, is really got a lot of work to do. I think that it's important to retain the two meetings. I just wanted to make a brief comment about Section 8 and the director's compensation. And this is a practice that I think you may need to work on, but any meeting that is attended by a director requires a written report. And while some of you may be doing it, I don't think it's done consistently. And so it's imperative not just to document the proceedings of any given meeting, but really to justify your pay. And it helps the district establish a record. So, and this is state law, by the way, so it's not anything I'm making up. I think you need to continue an effort to enforce the written reports from each board member relative to a meeting that they have attended. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is April. I'm a Five Cities resident. I actually was going to come here and be in agreement that you should have less meetings, because sometimes I don't feel they're very effective, or that some of you are very knowledgeable about some of the committees you're on and may be a deficit to this district instead of an asset. But I gave it some thought, and the thought that only doing special meetings on the other times that you would hold a meeting very much affects the public who you were voted in to represent. So when we have special meetings, and while the general manager may say that you could use longer than 24 hours to notify the public, the fact that that would happen, I don't have very good faith in that. So that we would be afforded the required 72, I have much more faith in. And then you could cancel a meeting at any time, and I think that's fair. If the staff are getting paid overtime to sit here and listen to us windbag every other week, then that would be nice to cut that cost. But if that's what they're paid to do and that is part of their job, then maybe that's the price we pay for that. Speaking of the issues on the agenda, this agenda, every meeting at the bottom for items, has the same stuff listed again and again and again because you don't get to them. So you're not getting stuff accomplished during your meetings. So cutting down these meetings wouldn't be helpful. If you have these things already on your to-do list and your to-do list isn't being addressed. To speak to that, we have two items on this agenda tonight that were never on a previous to-do list. So that makes me wonder, were some of these items from a closed session meeting that there was nothing to report out of, and yet here they are on the agenda now? I don't know, it was a closed meeting. But that's something the five of you may know the answer to and should question and wonder. So if we're putting on items that aren't even on last meeting's agenda on the current meeting, when are you going to get to the things that were already there? So again, I surprised myself. I don't think you should cut the meetings. I think you should consider who are on special committees and their inability to understand the topics at hand that they're on, and maybe put people who are more specialized or knowledgeable or have a skill set that fits those committees better than how you've represented it so far. And I look forward to the next meeting where we talk about that. Thank you.
Good evening again. I am Julie Tacker, and two meetings a month is fine. You do clearly have a lot to do in this coming year. You might revisit the subject in a year or so. Another vote against special meetings is that they're not required to have public comment for items not on the agenda, and I think you want to give the public that opportunity at every chance that they can. Another point about special meetings is, again, it's the 24-hour notice, and in fact, perhaps your district could establish an electronic agenda subscription where people are getting that agenda sent to them without them having to go, oh, it's Friday, or oh, it's Saturday, I got to look at what's coming up for Oceano. That way, when a special meeting pops up, maybe they didn't look for it. They wouldn't know that it's there. So an e-scription would be great. If you do want to cost savings at your meetings, I see Carrie is here, I see Tony is here, and you're not always having financial items or water or sewer items. So like tonight, I don't know how Carrie's involved in the Voting Rights Act, how she's involved in the bylaws. I see Celia is taking your minutes and doing the clerical work. So those are two people that are paid to be here and maybe could only be here one time a month and stagger it or something. But it doesn't make sense that you have staff sitting in the room on items that they're clearly not going to be addressing. With regard to the compensation, I really bristle at the idea that the committee meetings go to this $100 maximum. I almost think you should just leave it alone, leave it the way it is. Find another way to share those committees that don't compensate so that that's equal and that everybody's going to have some duty that doesn't get compensation. I just don't like the approach on this one, and ask you to look for something else. I think those are pretty much my thoughts. I think written reports for committee assignments, because not always do you speak to all the verbal things that you, when you do have your director's comments, You're not always hitting all the things that happen at those meetings. So if there's a little written report and it's attached to your packet, everybody's on board.
Thank you. Any other comment?
I just have a brief comment. So,
excuse me.
Oh.
We have a...
Good evening. My name is Brad Snook, Five Cities resident. Since I was at the previous meeting and since I had a chance to review on video the committee assignments meeting from December, I decided to make some comments on the bylaws tonight. There appears to be a conflict between what's written in the Constitution and what happened at the December meeting. So I think this is an opportunity, since we're talking about the bylaws, to introduce at the top of your bylaws that you uphold the U.S. and California constitutions and you comply to the Brown Act. That'll reduce some of the Brown Act language that's further on down in the bylaws. You can just remove it altogether because it says at the top that you're going to comply. I also have the redundant number 3.5 that was added to the bylaws. You can take it out because it's already included in 3.1, pretty much the same thing. 5.3, once the board takes action, directors should commit to supporting the action and should not obstruct implementation to the action. That's vague. Obstruct, don't know what it means. Needs to be clarified more because 6.5, the second part of it is actually much more clear. And it says that the board members make it clear that they are speaking on their own behalf and not representing the district or board of directors. So if it's good to do at a different meeting, it should be good to do in this meeting too. So I just think that you should take the language from 6.5 and just remove 5.3 altogether. That's it for me. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, seeing none, we will bring it back to the board and we will.
I just had a brief comment on comments about some staff that are attending meetings. Those are salaried staff, so it doesn't cost us any more. They just are here for the fun.
Thank you, Mr. Clemens. Okay, so we basically...
May I ask a couple questions related to the comments? Is there a state law that says the committee reports should be written? Or are the verbal reports that we have been doing, is that acceptable?
So I believe that there is a requirement, and you're testing me, go ahead.
So in reviewing that, the government code does have that requirement, but the water code also discusses compensation for water district board members, which you are, and as long as you have a written policy, you can get...
It's really hard for the people up here and for us to hear when you guys are talking in the back, so please.
So district council can probably look into the relationship between those two codes and which one trumps which.
They do. There is a number of different codes that address water code. Is correct, and the government code, I think general manager is correct. Government code says that board members should provide written reports from committees. But there is several different codes that interrelate that have to be read in harmony, so I'll get back to you to be sure on that.
Okay, thank you. It might actually be valuable to have the written reports.
I see two sides of that. I thought I'd just mention it. Number one, we're going to file all these written reports every month. There's more
paper that's superfluous, maybe, or?
Well, I don't think there's any requirement that a written report has to be produced as part of an agenda package. I think the idea of the written report is so that you have a reference guide, even if you use that as an oral, as a guide. And I see, generally speaking, I see the board members do show up with notes. And
yeah.
To me, that would count.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So we're going to move on then to our next. We said majority was fine. Now we're down to three committees. 3.2, all standing committee meetings shall be conducted as public meetings. I'm going to leave that. In accordance with the Brown Act, then. You guys looking at this? Everybody agree we want to believe all standing committee meetings?
Hold on, I gotta get to the right page here.
Well, it's page, mine's blocked out, but it's.
Why is it in red? Is it
3.2 of the bylaws?
3.2, we added standing.
Oh, okay.
And that's because ad hoc committees,
okay,
meetings don't have to be.
They dissolve after they're not.
And they don't have to be noticed. Okay.
Well, what about the
two members?
Yeah. What about the suggestion to put just at the top of the bylaws that we comply with the constitutions of the United States and the state and with the Brown Act, and then we don't have to have all standing committees shall be conducted in accordance with the Brown Act? It just generally applies?
So you are obligated to comply, and you take an oath of office to support the United States Constitution and the state of Constitution when you take your oath of office here. So we know that. Yes, it is correct that your bylaws, that is very common, tend to reiterate certain things that are in the government code and the Brown Act, and that's not uncommon. I think it's done simply as a reminder and to provide an easy reference point. So your bylaws basically adopt the provisions of the Brown Act. Just as a reminder, I believe. So you could take everything out. You're still obligated to comply with the Brown Act, but it's your whatever the board prerogative.
I'd like to leave it just in accordance with the Brown Act. It just doesn't hurt to have it mentioned again. So everybody agreed to leave the standing?
Yeah.
Okay.
So on 3.5, this brings up a question for me about the Social Media and Technology Outreach Committee. So would this apply retroactively? Could the board kind of decided not to have that committee anymore? But it hasn't done a final report, so does it still exist? I'm just unclear if that committee still is in existence or not.
So this change would not be effective until adopted by your board.
If it's adopted, I'd like to understand the status of this Social Media Technology Outreach Committee and if this would be applied to it or if it's already gone.
We basically took it off because we thought it had been completed. And that was the thing that you had left, so then we had something to say, but we didn't know. So I think that's how it happened.
Do you still want that? Do you want to head it? Because I didn't feel confident.
I'm just trying to ascertain whether it exists now or it doesn't exist
now.
Why
don't we bring that up when we do the committee?
Okay.
I believe that's coming up ahead.
Yeah. In the committee assignment. So, 3.5, is there anything in there that... Somebody said about the number of people on an ad hoc is like two, isn't it?
It has to be two. It says it above on 3.3.
The ad hoc committees can only have two board members because otherwise it wouldn't comply with the Brown Act.
Well, and I don't think any committee is supposed to be more than two.
Right, it can't be.
It can't be.
And then we have the 3.6 committee assignments of district will be coordinated with the election of district officers only.
3.6 was not really a change. It just changed the numbering.
It was just the, oh, the numbering. Okay. So that's, okay. Got it. So we're all good there, that page. Then we go over to 4.3. So we're taking off, and whether they spoke in support or opposition to such matter.
So I've seen minutes from other city councils and maybe the sanitation district that are a little more explanatory in terms of what people are talking about. And I wonder if it might be possible to just have like a sentence that captures what they were saying, not whether they were in for or against something, but just like their main point. Could just so we have a little more information in the minutes than just that somebody spoke.
I think that's open to interpretation, though, and then that runs into the problem.
You've got the, you've got
what the, did somebody mean? And
electronic recordings.
Right. And I don't think we should put that on staff to make those decisions.
Right, because they can say, I didn't. It's like you said, interpretation.
But other bodies do it.
Well, not a bodies don't, too. It's just, it just depends. So I think I like it. I want to leave it the way this is. They spoke in support. Take that out.
So anyone else? Seems like a consensus to leave that, to strike that language.
You guys want to say? Do you want to strike it?
No. Yes.
Strike it?
Yeah.
Okay, I think the consensus is to what?
Yeah.
To strike it.
And lastly, director compensation.
No, let's go to 5.3.
What was that?
5.3. The California Special Districts Association handbook has a different wording than this one. And I think it's about the same.
So, Mr. Clemens, you had made a comment to a reporter at the New Times that most governments have this bylaw. And when I asked you to tell me which governments did, what did you say?
I said I stand by my comments to the New Times.
And did you tell me which governments have this bylaw?
I could go through a list. I could look up all 3,400 special districts and tell you which ones have it, but I'm not going to do that. So.
But you didn't find...
All right.
You didn't
answer your question.
No, he hasn't.
Yes,
I am proposing that we strike this altogether because I was not able to find any government bodies who are actually using this. Mr. Clemens pointed only to the CSDA template bylaws for this language. I didn't find any governments using it, and it's unconstitutional.
Most of the CSDs in San Luis Obispo County have this exact same language.
And you're telling me this, but I spot checked some and I didn't see it, and you didn't provide any.
That's what I'm telling you.
Which is a far cry from most governments use this. But again, it could be implemented in a way that's unconstitutional, and it does conflict with 6.5. So I think we should strike it.
On 5.3, I think Mr. Snook made the comment, which took it right out. I had here that this does need more clarity, mm-hmm. And I think we need to add to this and have some language added saying what action qualifies to implement 5.3.
And then
what does the board member do? And we're not talking about freedom of speech to speak at a meeting as your own person and not as a member of a board. We're talking about public statements in opposition to duly executed decisions, like on Facebook and on other, where, that you're not supporting the action of the board, and it has nothing to do with your freedom of speech. So I like to see this 5.3 stay like it always has, and then I want to add to it to spell it out.
Well, I want
so we don't have any more questions of what's, you know.
So in other words, you don't want it to stay as it as is. You want to amend it, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. I think we need to define supporting. You know, how do we support? And expand on that, and then at the same time, define what obstruct means.
Right.
So if we can add to those two, then it'll be much clearer than it is now.
Well, I want 5.3 changed with 1.7, but there's a little different wording.
What does it say?
Differing viewpoints are healthy in the decision-making process. Individuals have the right to disagree with ideas and opinions, but without being disagreeable. Once the board of directors take action, directors should commit to supporting said action and not to create barriers to the implementation of said action. And I would like to add to that some kind of system, ad hoc committee, I know I'm getting complicated, or some way that when this comes up, there's a way to study it or talk about it or work it out. That's what I would like to see. Mm-hmm. So that's my thoughts.
I think we can't come up with that. I think it has to be council that can give us like actual examples so that we are not violating any free speech or any other discrimination.
And civil rights.
Well, he can law. He can review what we propose.
Yeah.
But
anyway, I would like.
I mean, defaming board members on social media and things like that is what we're talking about, I think.
So defamation is already unlawful.
I think what may be worthwhile looking at, other than maybe worthwhile for your board. The language is in the CSD. I actually looked up Los Osos's bylaws while we were talking. They have similar language. Section 8.3 of Los Osos bylaws, once the board of directors takes action, directors shall commit to supporting said action and not create barriers to the implementation of said action, is what they're saying. So I think maybe what your board is talking about is not necessarily a change to the bylaws necessarily, maybe that you leave it the way it is, and then consider essentially rules of decorum of how you handle these things and how you address those, and that may be another avenue to approach this issue, which generally I don't think comes up too often as a problem.
Well, I still would like 5.3 on R change to 1.7. I think it's clear, and I think it's, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I just think it's nice, better word.
I have brought paperwork.
1.7 under ethics policy number 4010.
So you're saying just move 5.3 to 1.7? Make a 1.7?
Make 5.3, make 1.7 5.3. It's.
What can we do? Because I did look up some rules of decorum I wanted to kind of like include in these bylaws or make it separate, however the board, that covered board interaction and public interaction with the board meetings.
President Austin, I do have examples of other agencies that have rules of decorum.
Because we want to make it very clear that I don't want it to happen what happened before about freedom of speech, that is not the case. So I want to make sure that we don't get that hitting us again. So however we have to word it.
So what I've heard is we want to come up with some rules of decorum separate from the bylaws that will address bylaw 5.3.
I think
and other
so,
issues.
Yeah, about treating each body with respect and not.
Well, I think we refrain from criticizing the board after we have voted and set policy.
That would be unconstitutional. You can't use the power of a government body to tell people that they can't criticize.
So, because it gets dicey as far as how people act independently, individually, what their rights to free speech is versus this, this is essentially not an uncommon appears comes from the CSDA directive that board members do support final decisions of the board. So I think really it might be best to leave the language the way it is now and then deal with it in rules of decorum. Because I don't know that you're going to get to an answer on language tonight. So it's up to your board of how you want to proceed. But.
Okay, so we're going to leave 5.3, but 1.7, we want it to...
Well, it's about the same. When you put what they've done
more.
Is 1.3 and 1.2 are the same thing as 5.2 and 5.3, if you put them together, is 1.7.
I got it. Yeah.
But are you looking at the CSDA model? I'm not sure that the members of the public know what you're referring to there. You might want to read them to them.
I just did.
Okay.
I read it already. But it's the California Special Districts Association Ethics Policy Number 4010, and it's 1.7, differing viewpoints. And differing viewpoints are healthy in the decision-making process. Individuals have the right to disagree with ideas and opinions, but without being disagreeable. Once the board of directors take action, directors should commit to supporting said action and not to create barriers to the implementation of said action. And I think a key word that is should doesn't say must. Right, attorney?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, I think you have that direction.
Are we going to track, is your board's desire to track the language of the CSDA in that section?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Yeah, but I think we need to define what the barrier is, what's like, acceptable
that's,
and not.
That's in the rules of decorum that we're going to come up with.
Okay.
Unless you have another idea.
So.
Yeah, a barrier is something that needs a definition.
Yeah, we need that defined. I mean, because in the end, we're all here for the community. And so when a policy decision is made, it helps the community if we're all implementing it and supporting it.
Well, what we do, like as a board, we don't always agree, but then when we make a decision, it should be made and for the betterment of the community, so we don't look like this. You know, we want to look like we try to work together, and it's not coming out.
And I think we can work together to craft some rules of decorum to bring back to your board that address our bylaw 5.3, and if we can figure out a way to define the support and obstruct, we might be able to include that in the rules of decorum. That's kind of what I got from you, Director Villa.
I would also like evidence because I wasn't able to actually say, you know, this happened or didn't happen because I didn't see or hear. So every time I've seen Cynthia, she has been pretty, because I remember in the beginning of the year, she got in some trouble, hot water or whatever you want to call it, because of her people thinking that she was speaking as a director when she wasn't. She was speaking as her own, or I don't know, you know, I wasn't there. But after that, every single time that I went to a meeting where she happened to be, I don't go to every single meeting because Cynthia goes to like a bazillion meetings. And it seems like, but I go to some meetings, and she was clear. But you know, I'm not saying that Karen didn't see that because she probably did. So I think that we also have to have like evidence so we could show the public, and so the public can see, oh, look, she did do this, and this is against the decorum rules. It's not just these people thinking that she said this or did this. It's like if you actually take a picture when you see it on Facebook or whatever, and we have the evidence, then it makes it easy. It makes it easier for everyone to accept the punishment that any of us can get if they see that there's evidence.
And so, President Austin and directors, maybe something your board could consider is that when a director is on a committee representing this board, or say on Five Cities Fire representing the board, or then that board member supports the action, and that might be distinct from a member of your board going to Pismo City Council and expressing their own opinion when they're not there as assigned by the board. Maybe there's a line like that. So mm-hmm. when you are assigned by this board as a committee member on and representing the board, you will support the board's decision. Maybe I'm just giving you thoughts of, as far as where those lines are drawn.
But we also need to address the social media part.
Okay.
Because that's what Karen had an issue with. Yes. And, you know, I can see where I would get extremely upset if someone defamed me on social media. And then if there's no evidence, there's like, it's hearsay, right? So next time this happens, Karen needs to take her phone out, camera.
She doesn't have a phone or a camera, and she's not on social media.
Oh, okay. Well, if we see each other defaming, we should get the evidence so that it's not just like, oh, she's just saying that.
That's fine. Okay.
Well, I'd like to know Vice President White and myself, that we're always singled out as coming from Halcyon.
That's a problem. They're part of the community, too.
Right.
Or older white people. That's discrimination.
Yeah.
Well...
So I think we have enough direction to come back.
This
issue.
Well, we have there's, and this may be just semantics, but I'm just bringing it up. Mm-hmm. Okay, on our thing it says not. Once a board takes action, directors should commit to supporting the action and should not obstruct implementation of the action. The ones from the state say. Should commit to supporting said action and not to create barriers to the implementation of said action. I see those as two different meanings. I see the one that we have is actually, I think, a little stronger. But, and at the same time, we don't have a definition of what obstruction is. We don't have a definition of what creating barriers is. I'm just saying it's doesn't say anything concrete to my eye is why I'm bringing it up. Sorry. Yeah. Well, if we're going to deal with it, we got to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Sorry, I'm wordsmithing. Well, I'm not.
Well, we can certainly bring back the rules of decorum. We'll try to address 5.3. At the next meeting.
And we need one other issue. I think we also need to put in the rules of decorum something about closed session. That I think there should be something, and I think I've been real close to being guilty myself. Revealing stuff in closed session should result in something like censure or because that's another thing that we have to be really careful with because it's going to get more critical and it might as well get down in black and white so we have some rules because there's nothing on that.
Is there? No, there isn't.
Just you can't repeat anything on closed session.
Sorry. Okay. I'll shut up now for a minute.
So I think now the last
thing. Compensation, 8.1. So what does everyone think?
Well, this was sort of my idea. And my idea was that everybody, depending on what their committee was or what their committee wasn't, because how do you, you don't, I mean, sometimes you go to committee meetings, sometimes you don't go to committee meetings. I mean, if we got a $100 stipend to cover all the costs of whether we go to meetings or not, doesn't matter. We got that extra $100. I was looking at that with only one meeting, though. But it was so that everybody would be, have an equitable, we'd all have get paid the same. That's all I'm looking for.
Yeah, I'd like to separate the committees from the compensation, just have a straight across the board amount for everybody.
So, President Austin, if I might, one thing that I'm concerned about, I'm fine with you limiting the amount of money on committees if that's the intention of the board, but I think that we have to keep in mind that you should have to go to a meeting to be compensated, so no one can say that you didn't go to any committees all year and you took your stipend every month and that was some sort of gift of public funds. So there has to be a minimum one meeting.
Right.
So.
And then it wouldn't, I wouldn't apply for that because I go to one meeting and I get compensated by the sanitation district, so I would not put in for the extra $100 because I don't.
Extra 50 or what? Well, or we can just go back to the old system and get paid for the meetings we go to, or however anybody wants to do it. I just was trying to think of a way that we all got treated the same. Mm-hmm.
So my understanding of how this worked in the current system is the stuff at the top of the committee assignments, it says committee assignments and other agency boards and committees, which is generally what was the ad hoc committees that we set up plus committees and boards that we had voting powers on. Those were the paid ones. This is how it was explained to me. Those are the paid ones. You get $50 for attending the meeting. And the ones that were not voting positions, it's more going to for information like the IWMA or liaising with the supervisor, things like that, those were the unpaid ones. And that made sense to me. I have a general concern about dropping the compensation for directors too low so that it's going to shrink the pool of community members who are willing to serve on the board. You know, we want to have a diverse board that reflects the community. And earlier we talked about how we could make sure that everybody's vote is treated equally so that they get equal representation on the board. And if we drop the compensation too low, that's kind of going the other direction because it's going to discourage people who aren't able to, in a sense, almost volunteer their time because they have enough money, they're retired, they've got lots of time, they're able to serve without much money versus maybe someone who needs to get a babysitter to go to a meeting in the middle of the day, or they have to take uncompensated time from work to go to a meeting in the middle of the day, and you know the $50 stipend helps cover those costs so that they are more able to step up and be able to participate. You know, they're younger, they're working, they can't volunteer in a sense. So I think that we need to maintain at least a minimum level, and it seemed pretty low to me in general. Like somebody said, nobody's getting rich here. You know, and recently some like Slow City AG have given themselves raises because they recognize that issue. They recognize that you need to have a certain level of compensation in order to get a diverse group of elected officials. And the Slow City Council, there was an article in the New Times, they had a compensation committee made up of some people from the community, I think, maybe some former council members. One of them said, failing to compensate someone fairly for their time only leads to reducing the opportunity of who can afford to run for council. This is the reason the majority of city councils tend to be mostly retired and independently wealthy individuals. And then someone else said, I want the great work of this council to continue on, and the way to ensure that happens is by giving more people the opportunity to run. Increased compensation is our only mechanism for changing the pool of potential candidates to continue to truly represent the constituents of the city. So I would suggest either keeping it the way it was, or if we want to change it in some fashion, maybe we could have a compensation committee, get some community members to look at. I mean, this table is a good start, and thank you, Mr. Clemens, for putting this together. So we can see what other CSDs pay, but we could have a committee maybe to come up with what is a fair compensation for this board, rather than deciding tonight that we're going to cut it back a bunch.
How about $200 for the first meeting of the month and $100 for the second meeting of the month and nothing for the committees? I'm just looking at schemes.
Yeah.
You have a limit of $100 per day.
Oh, that's right. That
unless you want to enact an ordinance.
No,
indeed.
No, leave it the way it is.
Okay, do you want to then, like when we do the committees, just decide then which one's $50?
Yeah.
I think this is a way for everybody
to get. I think that's what we were trying to get away from was to.
We're going to make them all $50?
To have some committees that were paid and some that weren't, and then there could be accusations that I was put on the non-paying committees. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was the across-the-board approach.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But maybe an option would be...
What if we said 50 for every committee that you go to? Anything
pay for every committee meeting you attend, but make it
50 20 and 25 or
25 or something, and... whatever that balance is.
I don't like that.
I will tell your board that no matter what, you're maxed out at $600 a month each. So, so
I've never come anywhere near hitting that.
So no one's coming near. No one is, and even if you. So you have latitude on how you want to do this, but just so you know and the public knows, it's not. there's
it's
a minimal
not a career
incentive.
Opportunity.
Yeah.
And really, this is basically a volunteer job, so, and really, I'm not older, I'm only 70, and I'm also not wealthy, so, and I think I am part of the community, so.
So, what do you think? We should stick with our $100 per meeting, and then when we do the committees, do you want to make every committee $50?
No.
25,
no.
To my mind, it still makes sense to have the voting assignments be 50 and the non-voting uncompensated.
The
voting ones are really critical, and we want to make sure people can go to those.
Yeah, but I think you've got to take the money element out of the committees because, maybe somebody wants to get on a committee to get paid, and I think that would be wrong. So
well, somebody's going to end up on no committees that have any pay.
Right. So I say straight across. I say leave the committees out of it.
Either leave the committees out of it or make them $50.
Or make every committee fair. $50 no matter what, sort of.
No. Because not everybody's going to have the same amount of committees, maybe.
So a potential hybrid would be voting committees at $50, non-voting committees at $25.
No.
That seems reasonable.
That's why I was trying to figure out a way to just
committees and
give everybody
and everybody
the same
has to
amount
give a committee report.
I really think everybody needs to get the same amount. There's no question about I didn't get that committee and, all of that.
That's
back and forth. Let's keep it simple.
Either that or every committee is $50.
No.
But that doesn't work. I can't see. I'm on the Oceano Community, the Oceano Advisory. And I can't see taking any money for that one.
because I don't carry a voice of the Oceana Community Service District. It's just there to find out what they're doing.
But you know, see, really. That's the problem. Everybody's interpreting what that committee is worth or not worth. And so I think if we have a set rate, we don't have those concerns.
What do you think, Director Villa?
I think either way works for me the same, but everything, it has to be the same. $50 for each committee, or all committees are free, but our stipend is increased.
We can't do it. Yeah, well, that's what I was trying to do. Yeah, I think we need to think about it.
Well, make them all the same then? I'm kind of hearing consensus on that.
How could you make it work to do a set amount?
You can't.
So where it's fair.
They can't. Yeah.
Why not?
Mr. Clemens.
Yeah. What, you'd have to go at least one committee a month.
Yes, you get
so
one.
Okay.
Be free, and then the rest after that you go under no stipend.
Okay, that would work.
So everybody's got to have at least one committee meeting to go to a month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could do that.
How could anything so simple be so complicated?
That would just increase the... So I'm kind of hearing we want to keep everything the same, right?
Yeah.
I would like to see everyone receive the same compensation.
Yes.
So you're saying you want to hear everyone get the same compensation for the month, which mm-hmm. this does, except it's only $100.
Well, that's still, if we had two meetings and our committees, it would be $300. I never get $300 a month. I sometimes get $250.
So if we made the compensation the same for all the committees, and then the committees were allocated...
No.
So that everybody had the same number of assignments.
No, I think it's more that the first committee qualifies everybody for the 200 or 300, whatever it is.
100.
That doesn't make sense to me, because some people are going to be doing a lot more work for the same money.
Well, I mean, that's part of being a volunteer. I mean, Linda and I have been on numerous ad hocs, and we've never asked for money for that, and I don't even know if that's covered.
So that's why I would suggest pay every meeting committee and make it $20. So if you attend, or $30. Currently it's $50, right? So, but if we're expanding the number of these committees, that's going to get stipends... or compensation, as it's
but
described.
Can we just decide which ones when we look at the committees? Like, well, that one isn't going to need, you know, like.
I mean, you could do that.
Without being in front of me, I'm trying to picture how many committees and stuff. But
okay, I go to fire.
I mean, that's an option. Well, is we leave it the way the bylaws read now, and when we come up with the committee assignments, we asterisk on there which ones get a stipend, and you can, but then that's kind of going back to then who's going to get assigned to those committees.
See, that's the flaw. I think a set amount, you go to one meeting a month, and then you know you get paid for whatever you do that month,
or all committees get paid the same.
But you're still limited to $100 per day, right? So if that one...
That's the law. Isn't it $100 a day?
You can only get $100 for however many committee assignments
right.
if you do it that way.
Right. So
which, again, is restricting the compensation.
That would be 300 straight across the board.
Yeah.
Which is more than I get now regularly.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's many board members that get more than 300 a month.
That's assuming two regular meetings, and we've just talked about how we may be canceling some of them. So, mm-hmm.
So then, you know, that month we'd get 200 for one meeting and the committees.
It still makes more sense to me to compensate per meeting. Again, if I go back to the example of someone was serving who needed to take uncompensated time from work or get a babysitter, babysitter's like $10 to $15 an hour, and they only, you know, they might not be able to cover what they need to cover if they have, say, four committee assignments.
It's volunteer.
It's not. It's an elected position with the stipend. And we don't want to put at hardship people who choose to serve on this board.
I don't think we can afford to pay a living wage or something.
So
it's out of our...
Here's another thought. What if you compensated for board meetings, regular board meetings, like you intend to, $100, mm-hmm. and then you had $50 for each committee, regardless of what it is, but then put a cap? So currently, it's the statutory cap is $600 a month. You could cap that at something else.
At $100. No. And then you could go back to mine.
No.
Okay, well, what do you think we should do?
I think if we're going to finish the rest of our meeting, we should move on from this.
We can't get this resolved. Let's do this at the next meeting.
Can we think about it? Can we still get our pay?
We'll do what Jeff said and bring back three options at next meeting for you to choose from.
That sounds good.
So,
mine better be one of them.
Since we're talking about the bylaws, I did review them again for this meeting, and I didn't see in here what you told the New Times reporter, Mr. Clemens, that the bylaws condition committee assignments on support for board decisions. Can you point me to that clause in the bylaws?
That was not a quote.
Okay.
So I think we should move on from
yes.
that issue.
I think that's it for the bylaws.
No action needed, I don't think.
Okay. All right, so then we'll go back on our agenda. Did we do public comment?
Yep.
We did?
Yeah. I think she came late.
Do you want to come up and say something?
She came late. Yeah.
You came late, but you can go ahead.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Becca Just, Oceana resident, or Venturini. I just said my maiden name, sorry. what I don't see in the bylaws is how you hold directors accountable for their actions. There's no like formal, this is your punishment for not following the bylaws. I'm also wondering if these rules of decorum are just like a, this is how you should act, or if there is going to be some sort of repercussions. I also don't understand how the board votes on when to, I can't think of a better word than punish, but someone when the public is who voted for them in the first place. I feel like it should be the public that should make the decisions for if somebody should be stripped of all of their responsibilities, essentially. What isn't addressed is that what was slipped up, a big problem that happened with the board was the violation of the Brown Act, that when the committees were stripped from Cynthia, it wasn't agendized. And so what's the repercussion for the board for taking those actions without it being on the agenda for the public to come in and make their comments at that meeting? So I think that those things all need to be addressed in the bylaws. If the board wants to be strict, I feel like the bylaws need to be strict. Otherwise, there's no ground to stand on. Thank you.
Thank you. We did have that down for consequences. I had that. So we are going to be working on that one.
I'm sorry, what did you have down?
Consequences for...
in the, as a bylaws change?
No, it was in the 5.3, the language, what actions would be taken, what qualifies.
Decorum.
So then it would be like the consequences of if.
Would that be in the rules of decorum that you were talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. I did have one other suggestion on the bylaws, following up on some of the public comment. If we could include something that the committee assignments would be allocated with consideration to board members' expertise and area of interest.
I don't think that's it. I think it was just committee assignments allocated as to director's expertise, and I don't think...
Just putting some rationale behind how the assignments are allocated.
Well,
The thing I would say about the committee assignments, really, in most cases, to my experience, they are lobbying, political lobbying tools for this board. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're going out to lobby for Oceano's best position in a water mm-hmm. situation, best position in a fire system. Mm-hmm. So, maybe there should be some qualifications. I don't know. I was thinking that certainly if you had a very liberal supervisor, you wouldn't put a very conservative board member as the liaison for that supervisor, not even if the two people got along, because there could be action from the Democrats or the Republicans. I can just see all the political aspects of these committees, because they are political.
When you wouldn't want to put someone on a committee that is has negative thoughts on that board or that project or whatever, that you wouldn't want somebody there representing the district that's going to represent their own agenda too. So
I would just say your board already has that latitude in who they appoint, and by putting more language in the bylaws, you could be backing yourself into a corner if you have a board that's elected that no one has those certain qualities or qualifications. So I think you have the latitude to appoint who you see fit has the most qualifications for a certain committee.
I think the other thing is the board has to be confident that once a vote is taken and there is policy, that people are going to support
the board, not their own.
Yeah, support the policy, because if we're supporting each other and the policy, then we're moving Oceano, the community, forward.
Can I just ask another on the rules of decorum? Are you going to use copy them from somewhere and bring them back for us? Are we going to have it like for rules for in the meeting too, like for the public? Because
yes.
I want to make sure, I'll give this one, that no person attending a public meeting shall engage in disorderly or boisterous conduct, including but not limited to applause, whistling, stamping of feet, booing, or making any loud, threatening, profane, abusive, personal, impertinent, or slanderous utterance that disturbs, disrupts, or otherwise impedes the orderly conduct of the meeting. I think that's very important. Because looking back on our last meeting, we had a lot of disruption from the public. And I want to be sure that we're going to start out with the public understanding that this is a community meeting, and we're not going to treat our residents or our board or our staff in any disrespectful way. And when a member of the public, a homeowner in this community, comes up to that podium and is not called dirty names by the public. And I want to be able to have there's also a way you can, that when someone does that, they get one warning, and then you can ask them to leave the meeting. I want to be sure that's in there too, because I don't want these meetings disrupted anymore by what happened last week by that group of people. So,
if this is the right place for it in the rules of decorum, could we also include something about only allowing leashed service animals?
The dog was on a leash.
Into the meeting?
I'm not going to go into it. I'm just saying that we're not going to call. When a homeowner, a disabled veteran, walks up to the podium, not minding his own business, and he's called crazy by a member of the public, we're not going to tolerate that kind of behavior. And he didn't say anything to anyone.
I agree that disruptive conduct should not be.
The disruption was your friends. You sent an email that I had let my friends know. So I don't want to discuss it. I'm just saying we're going to start over, and we're going to have the public treat every member with respect as they want to be treated. And we're not going to have anybody calling names or making fun of people that live in this community, that are homeowners and ratepayers in this community, that volunteer and do lots of work and have a lot of value to this town, not trying to just tear it down. So
I had raised a concern about what is the district's liability if someone's dog that's wandering the room bites somebody.
It's a trained service dog. It doesn't bite. It
goes. I'm not talking about specific. I did, but there are other people who have brought dogs in here.
Jeff Edwards brings his dog without a leash, and that's okay.
No, I'm saying it shouldn't be allowed at all.
But
nobody should bring a dog in or any other sort of animal that's not a service animal that's under control.
And the dog is under control. It's a service animal, and it was on a leash.
If the rules
that's
of decorum are the place for that.
We're done. Okay. We're done with it.
You're gaveling a fellow director?
I said we're done talking about it.
I want to move on to the.
Yeah, we're going to move on to our report. I just said that what I wanted in that.
I don't want to sit here.
Rules of decorum, and you've been. Yeah. So what else did you want to say? I already told you the dog was on a leash.
I was in the middle of a sentence asking Mr. Minnery if that was the right place, if some language could be included about service animals.
Go ahead and answer the question, Mr. Minnery.
I think we'll look into it and bring you back robust rules of decorum that address the issues as identified by your board tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Minnery.
Okay, let's go to our staff reports. Utility, Tony Maricino.
Good evening, board. Tony Maricino. So Lopez is currently at 51.5% full, which is 25,422 acre feet. We had zero SSOs in the month of January. That's a calendar year, so pumping and state water starts over. We delivered zero state water, and we pumped 0.05 acre feet. We've used our allocation of Lopez, and we're currently in our carryover, which is at 218.80 acre feet. So we've had our daily rounds, our samples, 11 work orders, 5 USAs, 7 customer service calls, 1 after-hours call-out for a turnoff on 4th Street to do repairs. Continue working on the common codes from the meter reads to improve whatever the operators put down, whether it's weed abatement, raising meter boxes, replacing meters. First of the month, equipment runs. We're really focusing on hydro maintenance right now. We found a few valves that are not operating properly on hydrants. We had to replace one of the valve stems on one of the hydrants. Still continue to do meter changeouts. As for the drainage project regarding our water lines, whether they're going over or under, they are all currently complete. The only thing is there's a few of them that have to come back online due to thrust blocks curing. And as for the hydrant on Railroad, that has been the one that got hit. It is put back into service tomorrow. It's rebuilt, reconstructed, ready to go. Any questions?
Yes. Generator, what's the status?
So as for the generator, the last part has been engineered by the electrical engineer. We're currently waiting on the cost estimate from the electrician. And as soon as that gets done, we'll find out a time and a cost to complete that.
It's been so expensive and so long. Are we going to have a dedication?
Sure.
I'm just joking. You know, I started talking about this before I came on the board.
Yes, you did. Yeah. It was before I even got here. They've been talking about it. But We do have emergency power, though.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Clemens?
Yes, so for your information, I was appointed by State Controller Betty Yee to represent special districts on the California Uniform Construction Cost Accounting Commission. Previously, I was representing counties, and so now officially, I represent special districts. We had a meeting with the countywide water action team, and the efforts of that team right now are focused on the regional water infrastructure resiliency planning and really developing a methodology for identifying vulnerable agencies and preparing a listing of vulnerabilities by agency. We've met a couple times with the Prop 1 grant-funded stormwater capture and groundwater recharge project team. So they're the ones that presented to your board in December on the infiltration project at the school and the low-impact developments. I think it's on 19th Street. So those efforts are going along well. We met with the school district. They're going to plan to bring a letter of support to their board in April, and we'll be doing the same here. The infiltration basin part of the project is going well. They are running into some constructability concerns on the 19th Street portion, just because it's kind of a crazy street with the utility poles where they're placed, and they're running in some difficulty in the design. So if there's any significant changes in that design, they'll bring those back in April as well. Director Replogle and I attended the local chapter of CSDA, their annual meeting, and we heard from the county administrator, the director of emergency services, the executive director of LAFCO. And so it provided some good information on things going on countywide. I also attended the Zone 3 TAC meeting, and at that meeting we formed a subcommittee to review draft contract changes for the Zone 3 contracts. So I volunteered for that subcommittee since I have extensive history with those contracts. So hopefully that will move those efforts along. And I think that's the end of my report.
Okay. Any questions? Comments?
No, I was just going to make one comment about the CSDA meeting. One thing I learned from something that the LAFCO director said was that, if you recall, last fall the board majority voted to submit an application for divestiture to LAFCO on the theory that then the county might respond in terms of what assets they would want if we divested of fire emergency services. That application was never submitted by the previous general manager, so it's still pending. I mean, it's not pending. It hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah, so that's true. Wouldn't make sense to submit an application at this point in time because it would be too late to get any information from the county. So a better plan would be to wait until the results of the election and determine if that needs to be submitted at all.
Okay. I had a question. Did Mr. Church say anything about the, I think it's called the Oceano-specific plan, or one of the Oceano plans that LAFCO is working on updating? Have you heard anything about that? Because I have, and I just...
Yeah, I'm not sure if he mentioned it at that meeting.
I don't recall it.
But LAFCO is preparing their municipal services review of Oceano. They've prepared an administrative draft, which is being reviewed now, and eventually that will be available for public review.
Yeah, I was contacted to provide some specific information on the Halcyon Historic District. which they did not know existed, so.
Okay, let's move on to outside directors, committee reports.
Director Austin, if I might mention, I saw the sheriff's representative, Commander Manuelli, and he said that if he's not called at the beginning of the meeting, he's not going to stick around, like if we have a closed session or something. So
I know that was because of all the confusion with
I should
have been called at the very beginning.
Yeah, I just wanted to point that out.
I didn't do that, and it was a mistake, and I should have done it. And he was gone before I came, but with all the, you know, with all the hoopla, I got sidetracked with all your people. So, Director Villa, do you have any?
No.
Director Gibson?
Nothing to report.
Vice President White?
Nothing.
Okay, I attended the South County Sanitation. I have my written notes. We elected our chair and vice chair. Karen Ray is the chair, and Jeff Lee is the vice chair. We were presented with our 2018-19 audit, and it was received and filed, and it was a perfect audit, very clear. Everything was great. Our clarifier two, we've awarded the contract for the rehabilitation to Fluid Resource Management, and that's in the amount of $243,257.34. So it's, you know, the clarifier has reached its lifespan. It was put in 1992, so it's definitely in need of the refurbishing. As far as the redundancy program, the contractor pre-qualification efforts are occurring, and in late February or early March, there will be a big meeting with the project overview meeting with the public and both all the councils, I believe, probably us too, that so to go over the project for everybody to learn all about it. And that's to be determined. It hasn't been determined yet. So that would be an interesting meeting. Our next meeting will be in Arroyo Grande at the boardroom there. We've been meeting in Grover. Now we're rotating, so it'll be March 4th. At 6 p.m. in Aurora Grande. That's the end of my report. Is there any public comment on special presentations and reports? Okay, we'll move on to the consent agenda items. We have the minutes of the regular meeting December 11th, January 22nd, January 23rd. Special meeting January 25th, and the review and approval of cash disbursements. Is there any public comment on these items? Seeing none.
President Austin, I just have a question on A, the December 11th minutes. I had asked at the last meeting to include that the Social Media Technology Outreach Committee had been dissolved, and that's still isn't in there, so I'm
where's
just
that?
Very unclear. It's in the committee assignments portion, but I'm still just really unclear on the status of that committee, if it has been dissolved, or if that's part of the reconsideration of committee assignments next time.
We're going to talk about that in the committee meeting, next meeting, when we discuss committees.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Whenever we discuss committees, we'll talk about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments on this? So can I get a
I make a motion we approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Items A, B, C, and D.
Can I get a roll call, please?
Vice President White?
Yes.
Director Villa?
Yes.
Director Gibson?
Yes.
Director Pogel?
Yes.
President Austin?
Yes. Okay, that brings us to our hearing items. Nothing?
Actually, I think
we need 9B.
Oh,
keep going.
Yeah, oh darn, I thought.
No worries. President, awesome members of the board, I can make this fast. We have your second quarter budget. In summary, all the variances are positive through December 31st. The expenses that were highlighted in your staff letter. The same ones that were front-loaded in your first quarter budget review are still front-loaded, so like LAFCO and your liability insurance and your CalPERS unfunded liability. Then we also have listed out the expenses that appear high but are expected to level out. Those things are costs related to Muni Code for the codification of the district's ordinances and resolutions. We have water meters, since staff was changing out water meters. Expenses related to well number 8 during the emergency action back in July. All these are really similar to what we covered in quarter 1, nothing too surprising. So the only thing that would be really different is the franchise fees that we'd be receiving from South County Sanitary. They've been estimated to be at that 5%, so you'll see we're lower than what we budgeted back when we were getting 10%. So that would be the main change, and if there's any line items that you specifically have questions about, we're happy to answer. So, unless you want me to go into more details.
Yeah, I didn't. Anybody have any questions on? Should we wait for Director Rapoga to come back before we move on, I think? Well,
it's just a receive, isn't it?
Yes, receive.
Finally, receive.
Okay, well, I guess we can. I don't know.
Thank you. It looks very good.
Very nice.
Yes.
It's pretty much the same as quarter one.
Well, that's certainly what we wanted. Certainly, that's what we want in a budget is nothing exciting. Thank you.
If nobody else have any questions, so we'll just consider it received in
the
file.
How about public comment?
Public comment, yes. Is there any public comment on the budget report? No? Okay. So we have any written communications?
Excuse me,
any received written communications?
Late.
The emails that we got?
Yeah.
Okay.
They'll be posted to your website as handouts as well.
Okay. We went ahead and it was a receive and file. Did you have any questions for the budget? Okay. We hope you did. Okay. Then, what do you want? Maybe the end of that. Then I guess if there's nothing else.
Future budget items.
Future hearing items.
I mean, future agenda items.
I think
items.
Everything's on there.
Yeah.
So if somebody want to make.
I had something. Can we, I mean, we talked about this earlier, but I want to make sure that it's added in here to agendize talking about fireworks sometime before April when the permits come up. So we can have that discussion. There's a lot of people in the public who want to talk about doing something to restrict fireworks.
You talking about the stop the sale of safe and sane in our community? Is that what they want to do? Or I know they're concerned
or limit about it, or limit it to less than 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. I've heard various points of view from members of the public, but I know it's a hot topic right now. As that one resident, that one resident from the Strand brought up, and the sheriff commander Manuel came to Oceano Beach Community Association meeting and met with some residents and talked about it. So he's working on it as well, and he should be part of our discussion. But if we could get that on the agenda, maybe in a month from now or something, that would be good if the board agrees.
And what would be the...
Yeah, I don't have any. I think we'll just come up...
Talking about the ordinance.
The fireworks ordinance that we have, in effect, before...
Like...
When, we have it scheduled for the permits to go out. Have they been sent their letters, the people that sell fireworks?
Can you remind me of our process, Carrie?
Yeah.
So we bring... Yeah, we bring the item back in April, and they're not the permits aren't issued till May. So, if you want to do it before April, is that?
We need to do it before they decide to order fireworks.
Yeah.
But we're going to need to.
We could bring it back in March for
whatever
discussion.
Whatever the board desires.
And did I hear we want to have Commander Manuelli involved?
Yes.
Well, it's just a matter of whether we want to... Okay, the ordinance...
So like a discussion on enforcement of our ordinance?
No, it's a discussion on the ordinance itself. Safe and sane fireworks are allowed in Oceano every day of the year, 24 hours a day, unlike many, many other areas. And there is a large group of people who support that, and I think an equally large group of people who want that changed. We also have groups that sell fireworks stands here for the, and that's restricted by the Five Cities Fire Authority. We have a set of rules, but they coordinate the actual setting up of the booths is the issue selling the fireworks, or is the issue 365 days a year? So we need to kind of decide.
I think maybe it's both.
I think it's a little bit of everything.
So basically a general discussion of the ordinance. Is there any changes we want to make to the ordinance, or
I think we can discuss that, and especially how it's regulated on the Strand.
And enforcement issues with the ordinance. Mm-hmm. We can do that in March.
I wonder if this needs to be a specific meeting, because we need to be fair to both sides, because there are three nonprofit groups that support critically needed programs in Oceano with fireworks sales. So I mean, there really has two sides.
You mean a special meeting?
A meeting where we restrict the topic to one thing, mm-hmm. which.
I think. It might be hard to break it out.
Just have it at the first of the meeting.
Well, but, okay.
We could certainly try to limit other items on the agenda to make it.
Or have one discussion and bring it back to a special meeting. We could do that, too.
Yeah.
Just kind of see where.
Like a general overall discussion, and then if we need to break out a certain piece, talk about it at the next meeting.
We can do that.
And then it also came up before, but can we talk about removing the speaker overall time limit from the top of the agenda?
No.
Is there anyone else who'd be interested in talking about that?
No.
It limits.
Have we ever limited
people
anyone?
Speaking?
Maybe
let's not have it if we're not going to enforce it, because it does tell the public that we don't want them to speak on every item. I don't think that's a good message to send. We want public input.
No one in this public has ever been denied the right to speak in here, ever. Just like with Rebecca, she wanted to speak after I let her speak.
So let's take it off.
We're very
cordial
about that.
Let's put it on the agenda to talk about taking off that language.
No.
Could we put
Oh, I'm sorry.
Could we put on the agenda about some equipment for people who are hard of hearing to discuss that? Like, when's that going to happen?
We have it at today's meeting. But I don't know if there was anybody that used it.
Yeah, we had two options today. We had been contacted, so we had brought two options for hearing impaired, but no one.
Oh, you have it here?
Yeah.
Okay. So,
well, I didn't know that.
We at the bottom of the agenda, it says to contact us with any, accommodations you may need. Just give us, it says, at least 3 working days, and we were contacted, so we were ready. So just let us know.
Okay. And then lastly, for the next meeting, we're planning to have a discussion of Central Coast Blue on the closed session agenda. Correct? I would ask that we have that closed session at the end of the meeting instead of the beginning, so that we don't inconvenience people in the public who want to hear the open parts of the meeting and want to make comment.
I agree.
That's fine, yeah. I think Will prefers that, don't you?
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Something that somebody brought up who was hard of hearing was saying that when public comment happens and they're sitting behind them, it's really hard if they can't see their face and read their lips. And so if possibly the podium could be moved over and angled, I don't know how it works with the camera setup or something like that, but then the people in the public can see the person's face that's talking as well as seeing all of you, if that's... that's something that could happen.
We'd have to talk with the video guys. Thank you. Anything else? Anyone else want any last comments? Okay, then if we get a motion to adjourn.
So move.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Sign checks.